Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, April 8th, 2016. So I have been told this is our sixth study session on Leonida McLean's A Foot in Each World. We have one more session left after today. Hopefully it has been a constructive read. I really want people to keep in mind mental health as we read, and anything that comes through in the reading that we're getting this week and next week as we wrap up that reveal, how she was doing psychologically, any additional clues as to what led to her untimely suicide at the age of 32. This week we're picking up the essay. It's on page 134. It's Police and the Dynamics of Fear. Now, this was written in 1984, so this is about 2 months before her suicide. We're going to go through some of the different sections as well, but just kind of keep that in mind, and any major themes, concluding thoughts that you think we should carry forward with us as we get ready to wrap this book up. We'll finish it up next Friday. With that, we will get started. Context of White Supremacy, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, audio segment number one.
March 21st, 1984. Police and the Dynamics of Fear. Why did you have to pull up so close to him? This question was put to me by two passengers in my car on separate occasions last week as I stopped behind a police squad car at a traffic light. It was asked with visible fear. Why was even the nearness of the police so dreaded? And why is such anxiety triggered automatically in the black community? Then came the warnings. The police might jump out and drag us from the car, take us in to be strip searched, charge us with all manner of crime, and it would be our word against theirs. The tale built into a thriller. These nervous warnings seemed in contrast to the attitudes of defiant blacks in Miami last week. That city had its third disturbance in 4 years after a police officer was acquitted in the 1982 killing of a black man. Yet beneath the surface, there is a link between the inordinate fear of police expressed in Chicago traffic and the inordinate belligerence of a Miami rock thrower. Last week, Miami policeman Luis Alvarez, pleading self-defense, was acquitted in the shooting death of Neville Johnson, 20, on December 28, 1982. Johnson had been stopped on charges of carrying a concealed weapon, and his death ignited a three-day riot and that left another man dead and 26 people injured. After the verdict, people took to the streets again in Miami's Overtown, Liberty City, and Coconut Grove sections, yelling, "They let Whitey go." 1,000 police officers were mobilized. Violence was not nearly as bad as in previous years, but at least 20 people were hurt and about 500 arrested. It does not require analytical training to connect the dynamic in the emotions of paranoia and aggressiveness directed at police in cities hundreds of miles apart, or to wonder why they are so spontaneous. But understanding them requires more than the easy explanation of racism, even when all white juries, as in Miami, may deserve condemnation. These emotions are aimed daily at whoever is in uniform, and so black officers get it as much, if not more, because they often are seen as traitorous. These emotions, fear, and belligerence are not the polarized extremes they seem, but are hardly separated. The line between them is microscopic, like that between love and hate, genius and madness. The difficulty is in predicting which emotion will surface and under what circumstances. And these emotions rule the police as much as they rule the community. The environment in which the black community and police interact is like that of a prison. But many people refuse to draw this analogy because it is simpler to dismiss black behavior and endorse police behavior. Black people are just that way, the detractors would say, and be done with that topic. Cops are just that way, many in the black community will say, with the same quickness and error. If blacks do not like to be painted in such a fashion, then it is unfair to do so to the police, who see the most horrid of what is already deplorable in every community. Within this psychological and socioeconomic prison that walls in a good part of the black community, everyone and everything foreign is an enemy. In a jail, the guards relinquish their freedom for so many hours. So do police on duty. Police are an occupying army sent by those in authority whom the inhabitants cannot reach to sweep the minefields. So the police officer is society's proxy and its patsy in the very way the community is. And like news from prison, news about the black community and police is of two kinds: the inmates' cruelty to each other, black on black crime, and to guards. Otherwise, there is little news deemed worthy of coverage. The prison ghetto, the inmates' residence, the guards' police are best left unmentioned. As society would keep this culture generally out of its sight and mind, so it wants no part of the police or the black community's tales. And when this untidiness encroaches upon the conscience of civilized society in riots and mugshots on newspaper front pages, or worse, in crimes committed in the civilized zone, even then the command to police is to get the problem corralled, get it out of sight again. There is no thought of what could be done about such conditions or behavior. There is no thought in any of it, no rationality. there is just reaction, or too often overreaction, whether in a motionless car in Chicago or outside a ransacked store in Miami. And the two emotions will continue to feed upon each other and build until they defy containment. March 25th, 1984. Justice by castration is disgusting. From a female point of view, sentences of life in prison faced by four men convicted in a gang rape in New Bedford, Massachusetts, hardly seem sufficient. Two other men were acquitted in trials on charges that they raped a woman atop a pool table in a tavern a year ago in the Portuguese American community. Yet for some people, no punishment would be harsh enough for this hideous crime. Many rape victims and their most despairing advocate castration as punishment or even castration and jail. A judge in South Carolina has become their champion. Judge C. Victor Pyle has offered the options of surgical castration or 30 years in jail, the maximum in this case, to three young men found guilty in a rape and beating. Some convicted rapists have consented to chemical castration, in which a female hormone is injected to stem the sex drive. The three, Michael Braxton, 19, Roscoe James Brown, 27, and Mark Vaughn, 21, pled guilty to assaulting a 24-year-old woman repeatedly and burning her with a cigarette lighter in a motel in Anderson, South Carolina, a year ago. The man and victim are black and the judge white, so the sentence is being denounced as a return to the era of slavery when castration was common punishment. But the question really has nothing to do with color. The young men have some time to contemplate their dilemma while the judge's sentence is being appealed by their attorneys. It probably will be heard near year's end. Defense attorney Theo Mitchell says the appeal seeks to declare that the judge overstepped the constitutional bounds of his authority and to remove him from the case. Judges in Ohio and Texas have since followed Pyle's example. While the sentence was read, everyone thought he was joking. But this is as serious as cancer, Mitchell said. We can't even find a doctor in the state who was willing to perform the surgery. The doctors are standing by their Hippocratic oath that this is barbaric. The judge's action is not reasonable or legal. The judge has been quoted as saying that he at least is giving the men a choice. As for the defendants, in television interviews, Braxton said he is undecided. Vaughn is looking to prison. And Brown said he would choose castration because he could be destroyed either way. But choice or no, this kind of justice is disgusting. As ghastly as the crime of rape is, mutilating people as punishment is more ghastly. Women are human beings first. It is important to remember that, especially when others treat us inhumanely. Many women would maintain that they are more compassionate than men because of their biological role and that assigned to them traditionally by society. There is a segment of feminist thought that holds that this gentleness is not a strength, but a weakness turned against women by a male-dominated society. It makes them easy victims emotionally and physically. In daily life, and rape is a man's ultimate means of trampling both aspects of their being. The bulk of research on rape shows it to be more than simply the product of a sex drive out of control. Its trigger is violent, not sensual. If castration were made acceptable, even by choice of the rapist, there would simply be violence by other means. Think of the extremes to which this type of eye for an eye punishment could go. The lopping off of hands of thieves, or perhaps in what would be the male counterattack for castration, the disfiguration of female prostitutes. Many states need tougher rape laws and fewer stipulations on the admission of evidence, especially regarding the character of victims. A new Illinois law to take effect July 1st finally acknowledges spousal rape for the crime it is and removes from the victim the burden of proving she resisted. It also repeals 8 laws on rape and other sex offenses and establishes 4 categories with penalties ranging from probation to 30 years in prison. Gang rape warrants a fixed sentence of 30 to 60 years. Life imprisonment, certainly upon a second offense, is not unreasonable. The death penalty is never reasonable. Arguments against it parallel the arguments against castration. It is brutal and irreversible. This subject is not one to be dealt with flippantly, though it opens up any number of sick jokes. Many women polled informally on the matter were quick to condone it and with great seriousness. Most men were struck speechless. As surely as men mentally undress women, women mentally castrate men. That is as far as it should go. April 29, 1984. Jeff Fort can't be rewritten. The mention of gang leader Jeff Fort conjures many images, all of them terrifying. Yet there are community leaders who find him a man of impeccable character, dedicated to the good of humanity, and a pious man with enormous respect for authority and justice. And one even thinks he has the potential of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. or Jesus Christ. These descriptions of Fort were in letters to a parole board to help win Fort's early release on a 13-year sentence for conspiring to distribute cocaine. Fort is in the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, on a Mississippi conviction. He is studying for his GED diploma, said his lawyer, Charles G. Murphy. Murphy suggested the letter writing, but said he did not solicit the letters himself. The letter labeling Fort impeccable was written by an aide to State Rep. Larry Bullock on the legislator's stationery. Robert Lucas of the Kenwood, Oakland Community Organization can claim the pious tag, and businessman Noah Robinson of the Breadbasket Commercial Association was the one to elevate Fort to the stature of King or Christ. 14 such letters were written on Fort's behalf by people who would not seem the type to consort with Fort. They include ministers, former Alderman William Barnett II, and the concerned mothers of Woodlawn. I suppose there have been mothers concerned over the years about Jeff Fort, concerned about whether their children would encounter his gang members on the street and live to tell about it. What contacts Fort has, politicians, ministers, businessmen, are the kind any upstanding citizen would have. But having stood up for Fort, some of these people have had to account for their statements. Robert Lucas of COCO now says he wrote the letter on impulse, has written a second letter retracting the first, and would like to put the matter behind him. Businessman Noah Robinson issued a press release to explain his letter, emphasizing that he was not recanting what he wrote. He said he formulated his opinion of Fort on the young man's civil rights work, reiterating from the letter Fort's participation in 3 marches, with Martin Luther King for opening house in Gage Park in 1967, in which Fort shielded Dr. King with his own body from the sticks and stones hurled by angry, violent mobs. With Jesse Jackson in a hunger march to Springfield in 1968 and with minorities trying to break into the construction trade unions in 1969. But the explanatory press release is hardly as persuasive as some of the letter's passages. I want to take this opportunity to talk about Jeff Fort, not the one that the media has characterized as Mr. Notorious over the years. He has been socially and community conscious since early in his life. Jeff is a natural leader of men. He has God-given charisma. He also has a track record for standing up and fighting for the little man who is either too weak or too fearful to stand up for his own rights. And that's really a major portion of Jeff's problem. His sense of concern for others and willingness to challenge perceived injustice by those in authority have resulted in his being characterized by some as a dangerous man. History now refers to King and Christ as dedicated and determined. Whatever else Jeff might be, he is also dedicated and determined. If Jeff chooses to use his talents in a positive, constructive manner, he could be a powerful force for the good of mankind in general and his community in particular. But the point is that Fort has not chosen to use his talents positively. Since the early 1960s, Fort has gone from 2-bit 2000s, from leader of the Black Peacestone Nation gang to high priest of the El Ruckin sect, from hustler to real estate mogul, from menacing to malignant, although some of those years were spent in jail. The El Ruckin have muscled into the drug and real estate markets nationwide with a savvy that would shame an MBA. Their latest ploy for legitimacy in politics. They were discovered to be behind the political organization that pamphleteered for Jane Byrne, with Rep. Bullock reportedly the liaison. And this year, many of them joined Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan in going to the election board to register to vote for the first time, stirred by Jesse Jackson's candidacy. Getting religion and exercising the democratic right to vote cannot cover up what the El Ruckin really are, nor can these letters remold Fort. But there is one comparison, and every letter overlooked it. Al Capone.
Home and family. Home, to Leonida McLean, was a public housing project on Chicago's South Side. Her family was an African-American lineage mixed lightly with European white and Native American genes, a legacy of the slavery years that is not uncharacteristic of Black American families. Historical differences meant profound cultural differences that set her concept of home and family apart from the mainstream American image. While families of European immigrants might call up memories of Ellis Island, McLean's family would speak of a Greyhound bus or Chicago's old 12th Street Railway station. From all of this, McLean found many aspects of home and family that are the same for all of us, and she used these familiar reference points to introduce readers to her own home and family and to her views on weightier family issues like housing or abortion. May 24, 1981. More of a home to me now. While McLean was editor of the Tribune's perspective section, she wrote the following essay as an introduction to a special May 24, 1981 report profiling six successful Chicago professionals who had grown up in public housing projects. Mayor Jane Byrne had just moved into the Cabrini Green Public Housing Projects, a controversial and of course, quite temporary change of address that at least brought some long overdue public attention to the endless problems of public housing residents. But as a product of the projects herself, McLean did not like the way most of the publicity surrounding Burns' move portrayed public housing residents as little more than miserable and hopeless. With a team of reporters, she initiated a special report to give the other side of the story. Headline, Six Success Stories from the Projects. The section might as well have been entitled Seven Success Stories from the Projects. One of McLean's friends pointed out later, since McLean ironically had written a fascinating profile of her own years in public housing, yet had neglected to include herself in the count. The Projects. For many, their image is of squalid, foreboding hallways in which merciless thugs wait in ambush. They are, it is said, home to hordes of neglected children whose futures are sealed, to part-time fathers with no full-time jobs, and to pregnant young girls doomed to make the same mistake again. Chicago's public housing projects are all these things. Their woes should not be denied or underestimated. But beyond this, the projects are home to 140,000 people, a home like any other, where families eat and sleep and share ups and downs. Mine is one of those families. The projects were the only alternative for my family when an expanding Michael Reese Hospital brought my grandmother's house on 29th Street and Ellis Avenue. So when I was 5 weeks old, my mother, father, two sisters, and I moved into Ida B. Wells Homes. It was November 1951. My parents have remained there nearly 30 years in the same four-room apartment, though my sisters and I left like clockwork when we each reached 20. Ida B. Wells is one of the city's oldest projects, humanistically designed with three and four-story walk-ups and two-story row houses that front on grass courtyards, though the grass doesn't seem to grow as it once did. The original Wells, not including the Wells extension, a series of seven-story buildings built in the mid-1950s, includes more than 1,600 units. The project sits on 47 acres from 37th Street to Pershing Road, 39th Street, and King Drive, formerly South Parkway, to Cottage Grove Avenue. It cost $9 million to build. At ceremonies in June of 1941, the Diary of Ida B. Wells, the crusading black newspaper woman for whom it is named, was placed in a cornerstone. A year later, a Tribune story recounts, "The dwellers in Wellstown are jubilant in their new homes and easily the envy of colored persons still living in the rickety houses less than 50 feet from the gleaming new buildings." We said projects without hanging our heads. People in projects led lives as full of personal cheer as anyone else. Birthday parties, graduation celebrations, block club parties, and tearful farewells and funerals. In those poverty program days, there were dance classes and sewing classes and charm classes when we weren't roller skating or bicycling. There was a corner soda shop, Doc's, that made the best malts in our limited world. People raised money to pay the rent by selling baked goods or chicken dinners. Every Sunday morning, there was a parade of scrubbed Sunday school children. And every Sunday afternoon, there were white Bible students from Wheaton who came in without incident to nourish our souls and broaden our horizons. Every summer, the father of one friend set up a curbside candy stand that kept us amply supplied. And there was a day camp in Madden Park run by nuns. There were safe summer evenings sitting on the lakefront or on the doorstep watching the fireworks from Sox Park. And there were fathers who were fathers to those without them, and plenty of working people, factory workers, and domestics whose rush hour began long before dawn. No, it wasn't paradise. There were purse snatchings and burglaries, regularly scheduled weekend domestic roles, and gang fights that kicked up the dust in Madden Park and left bloodied noses or, at times, knife wounds. There were kids left unattended for days, a policy numbers den, though I never knew anyone who hit the jackpot, and women who worked by the light of the lampposts. But these were the exceptions. If there were drugs then, I didn't know about it. Wells was, for me, a decent place to live, built to last an eternity, dependably heated with abundant hot water. The projects were just right for bargain hunters, including teachers and other professionals, or for those down on their luck, but not down and out. Above all, the projects were a stopover. In my family, we were brought up knowing we would not have to raise our children there. Now, it is not uncommon to find three generations of a family trapped in the projects. The object was to get out, and get out we did. By my adolescence, when everyone's world expands beyond the corner traffic light, the stigma attached to being from the projects took hold. The smoothest talking suitors stumbled all over themselves to make a getaway once they learned my address. But the late 60s arrived and made being lower income, not poor, almost noble, especially for those making progress to better their lives. In college, having come from the projects was a great conversation starter. You actually lived in the projects? How many roaches do you own? Carloads of white classmates shuttled in to take a look at a real live housing project. I may be as alien to the projects now as were those old visitors. Still, there is comfort in rounding the corner from Pershing onto Rhodes and seeing the gates of Madden Park come into view. But now I wouldn't drive in mid-afternoon some paths that I strode at midnight in my reckless youth. My parents, now retired, insist on staying, though their activity is curtailed. They have never signed a mortgage on Ida B. Wells, but it is their home as surely as if they had. Old-timers who remember when the projects were a close-knit community, not a closed one, kept an eye on them. What has happened to the projects? Low-rise Wells has escaped the problems of Cabrini, but it's not the Wells of my youth. Is it the buildings or the people? That is a chicken before the egg argument, and the answer is, of course, that each has changed the other. I can see the building maintenance has fallen off, ostensibly because of financial problems, and that apartments are not painted as often. Locks were put on all outside entrance doors a few years ago. Window burglar bars are everywhere. Keeping hallways lit is a constant battle because of light bulb theft, even though fixtures requiring a special screwdriver were installed some time ago. The playground equipment in Madden Park is often broken. My parents sometimes clear incinerators of obstructions and scrub the halls to remove graffiti. As for the people, I see more young, single mothers trying to live out their stunted childhoods along with their children. And I see more aimless, jobless young men desperate to make an easy, illegal buck. Where there was simply poverty of the pocket, there is now also a poverty of the spirit. The projects remain more of a home to me now, even 10 years removed, than they ever will be to the present tenants. November 10th, 1981. Tragedy of illegal abortion. Anyone who ever held a girlfriend's hand during an illegal abortion has no choice but to be pro-choice. In June 1970, nearing the end of her sophomore year in college, Janet became pregnant. She didn't even realize it at first, when she couldn't keep her breakfast down. She went to the doctor thinking she had stomach flu, just a bug. The rabbit proved otherwise. There was little discussion. The thing to do was to finish school, get that degree. No one had time for babies. On that, everyone, including Janet's mother, agreed. No one had any doubts. An abortion was the only solution. Initially, some little magic black pills, ugly, hard to swallow, licorice-like, were tried to induce bleeding. They only made Janet more ill, more anxious. They had no label, no prescription, though they came in a bottle that looked like it came from a pharmacy. Perhaps they were someone's idea of a joke at $18 a bottle. Meanwhile, the search for someone to perform an abortion continued. The friend of a friend of a friend found someone, not a quack, but a real life practicing MD connected with one of the largest hospitals in town. Still, the abortion had to be performed in his home, in the guest bedroom, with Janet quivering and in tears. It was a painful night for everyone. Four girlfriends stayed over, but it was no slumber party. First, cold compresses were applied, then hot, then cold again as Janet tried to keep her cries muffled from the rest of the family. Janet's every convulsion was shared. It was not a pretty sight, certainly not one that could be forgotten. When it was over, no one ever talked about it again. Janet went back to the books, graduated, and is happy and successful today, and religiously taking her birth control pills. Abortion was legalized 3 years after Janet's ordeal, and anti-abortionists have been trying to reverse the decision ever since. It has become their cause in much the same way as ERA is for the feminist movement. Having failed in several attempts to reverse the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, which guaranteed women the constitutional right to privacy in choosing to have an abortion, anti-abortionists are trying a new tact. They are pushing a human life amendment to the Constitution. Hearings are underway in the Senate. In essence, the amendment states that life exists at conception, and that this person is deprived of due process as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. If scientists and doctors cannot agree on when life begins, how on earth can congressmen? Taking to its irrational extreme, this amendment would even outlaw certain birth control methods. For example, the morning after pill, it could be argued, might have been taken after fertilization. Abortion could be made criminal in some reactionary states. Women will never stop having abortions, but this amendment may send them searching, like Janet, for illegal ones again. It is a step backward. Abortion is an issue with few gray areas. However, one can be pro-abortion, but against the use of public funds to pay for abortions. Or one can be anti-abortion, except in the cases of medical emergencies or rape. Surely, abortion cannot be condoned when used repeatedly as a birth control method. Abortion is also a war of semantics. The anti-abortionist taking a cue from positive advertising psychology much prefer to be called pro-lifers or right-to-lifers. Who, after all, can be against life? The pro-abortionists mimicking the opposition are pro-choice. Shouldn't everyone have a choice in life? While the issue is not as starkly black and white, good and evil, as the anti-abortionists would have one believe, the time has come for everyone to stop playing the semantic game and come out on one side or the other. The anti-abortionists have been relentless zealots, even given polls that show 60% of Americans back the Supreme Court decision. But riding the moral majority, neoconservative, right-turn wave, they are particularly brazen these days. Many of them are the very people who would not adopt an unwanted child, who are all too quick to cluck their tongues at the frightened young girl who has made a mistake, who support cuts in social programs that affect the lives of children whose mothers cannot support them. Anti-abortion arguments delivered without hysteria deserve a hearing, but so does the story of Janet writhing on the floor. February 28, 1983. A Man's Discovery of Dignity. The following column written for the Chicago Tribune in February 1983 was not designed to be read right after her Newsweek's piece, The Middle Class Black's Burden, but it might as well have been. February, Black History Month, has been a celebration of heroes. Here is the story of one that has never been told. Memphis has never liked to consider itself anything near the Deep South. Yet, in 1929, it was as segregated and devoid of conscience as any backwoods spot at the turnoff of a dusty road. At least it was in Mississippi, the young black man, colored then by everyone's standard and proud of it, always reminded himself of that. He had escaped Mississippi at 9, running away from the white family in whose care his father had left him when he set out to get a good job with the railroad. Memphis has been his home ever since, but it would not be his home much longer. The day that was to change everything for him began like any other in his time clock existence. He had worked since he was 14, though a second grade rural Mississippi education hadn't advanced him very far. At 26, a job was a job, but he was always at work, always on time, and always looking elsewhere. He hopped aboard the morning streetcar and sat in his proper place. Then it happened. When the streetcar jerked to a stop, the scrawny young conductor said to a woman about to board, "You don't want to get into this car, ma'am. There are too many niggers." Nigger was a word as widely used as please and thank you, probably more widely used. It was as much a part of the ride as the announcement of the stops. Everyone heard it, but on this morning the young man felt it deep inside some hidden place. He tapped his buddy on the shoulder and gave a quizzical, mischievous look. "Fred," he said aloud and almost jokingly, "you see any niggers on this car?" Fred had heard the conductor's remark, but it wasn't Fred's day to feel it. Fred had felt his buddy's remark, however. What, Fred thought, has gotten into this fool? What had gotten into the young man was not ignited by the morning's remark. It was just that time in every black man's life when he had to feel something, feel his own dignity. Many of those who did so soon after left widows. But what had he to lose? No wife, no family, mother long gone. There was only his father, old Joe, who was just an acquaintance who popped in with tales of the promised land in Chicago, where there was no sharecropping. His instincts told him this was already a bad day. "What you say, boy?" the conductor demanded, striding up to the young man. There was that other word that everyone used. He felt it too, for the first time. The young man bolted to his feet, nose to nose with the conductor. Enough of a challenge from any black man to shave a few years from life. Who knows who got off the first slug? Nothing was rolling except the two bloodied men and a reluctant Fred. Finally, the young black man snatched the metal sign identifying the streetcar from a window. He slammed it over the conductor's head, not even with great force. The conductor fell to the floor, groaning. At the police station, the young man was booked, allowed a phone call, and beaten with a rubber hose. His hair was set afire. It was standard procedure for any black bold enough or stupid enough or both to hit a white person. This young man had never been in serious trouble before, carried a pocket knife for practical uses like skimming milk, opening packages, and trimming toenails. He was not, as the snarling police kept insisting, one of those troublemaking niggers. When the calls began to come inquiring about him from his white bosses, from his friends, from the lawyer they had contacted, it only made the police more indignant, more cruel. "Never seen so much interest in a nigger," spat one policeman. Freed on a lesser charge and fine, he returned to work, but his life did not return to its usual monotony. His white co-workers, in all well-meaning and solicitness, gave him a good preaching about knowing better than to go around beating up a white man. They secretly wondered whether this was the good-natured boy they all liked so much. No, he was not anymore. When he went to pick up his paycheck that week, it was $10 short. He asked why. "Who's going to pay that white boy's doctor bill?" was the only answer he got. Meanwhile, up north in the promised land, his father had gotten word of the trouble. Old Joe knew what he had to do. He knew the signs, the symptoms. If he didn't go get his son, he would soon be childless. He had had enough of losing his family to the influenza, to circumstance. His sister Fanny had gone to New York to work for a white family. For lack of knowing how to read and write, no one ever knew what became of her. Old Joe came back to Memphis and packed up his son. The young man protested, but his father's word was law. He would go. He headed out of Memphis for the promised land and has never set foot outside of Chicago since. This is living Black history. This is my tribute to Black History Month. This is my tribute to my father. September 11th, 1983. The CHA, my alma mater. Now that everyone has had his say about the Chicago Housing Authority, it's my turn. I just so happen to have lived in the projects from the ages of 5 weeks to 20 and still have relatives and friends living there who I visit just about weekly. Andrew Mooney, remember him? He's the well-intentioned, well-spoken young former chief of the CHA. He had his problems, not the least of which was that he worked for CHA, bad guy Charles Zweibel, in the latter whining days. For 20 years, no one at the local, state, or federal levels had bothered to look over Zweibel's shoulder. But when Mooney was named by Mayor Jane Byrne just a year ago, everyone was looking over his shoulder. Blue ribbon oversight panels, the state legislature, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, and the CHA board, which suddenly awakened to its responsibility. Given all of this, Mooney was doing the best he could concerning budgets, morale, and image. Whether or not he was taking orders from Zweibel or from Mayor Byrne, as was alleged, it appears his greatest sin at the CHA was being the wrong color. That is no more right than all of the years there were missing black faces. You don't have to be black to run the CHA, nor have grown up in the projects to have some sensitivity for them, but it could help. Mooney deserved, but never got a chance to prove himself. His replacement, Renault Robinson, was one of the factors in his demise. Yet, Robinson deserves a chance, too. Renault Robinson. His image is that of a troublemaker. Thank goodness for his troublemaking through the years on the CHA board, or there would have been no voice for the tenant. People who cannot accept Robinson must separate the Afro-American Patrolmen's League and CHA Crusader from the new CHA chief. Robinson himself will learn soon enough the difference between crusading and running a quasi-governmental unit. What the CHA as an agency needs is a good manager first. What tenants need is a crusader second. Robinson has the brains for the former and the stridency for the latter. He deserves the chance to discover that running the CHA is high on the top 10 damned if you do or don't jobs in this town for anyone of any color. Elevators. Robinson is learning his lessons fast in the great elevator flap. Spending $40 million to replace more than 400 elevators is nonsense. That's crusading, not managing. The problem with the elevators is not the elevators, but some of the people who use the elevators, especially vandals and criminals. Robinson's ideas to tighten security and help tenants simultaneously by hiring them as operators is good management and good crusading. As for the horror stories of the elevator repairmen, I can match, even top those. As a reporter some years ago, my purse was snatched in Tyler Homes by three flat-footed adolescents, but that didn't color my opinion of every resident in Taylor. And by the way, I was working on my day off, not on company time. If all of the elevator repairmen don't want to be painted as loafers, why should they paint CHA tenants as barbarians? The minority who terrorize the laborers terrorize fellow tenants more, and the tenants deserve the greater sympathy. Buildings. Central to the problem of elevators is the problem of high-rises. I grew up in Ida B. Wells, a series of low-rise walk-ups, no more than four stories at King Drive to Cottage Grove and 37th Street to Pershing Road. Even they lack the home sweet homeness of my youth. Where there were grassy courtyards, there are dirt patches. There are bars on first floor windows, and I've only been gone 10 years. It's time for someone to try just one grand social experiment. to come up with the money to relocate just one building of folks from Taylor or Cabrini Green into existing low rises or rehab six flats and find some hospital, school, skill center, or other organization or institution to use all or part of the empty building. If it doesn't work, at least it will have been tried. A community worker in middle class Chatham once was bold enough to tell me that if the people from Taylor Homes were transplanted into Chatham, you'd have Taylor Homes in single families. If insults can't be tolerated from elevator repairmen, such thinking can't be tolerated from a black person in Chatham, which leads to my last but most important point. Tenants. Only days before the flap over the elevators, there was much hugging and kissing of Robinson by nice little old CHA ladies. And the Chicago Defender ran lovely pictures of CHA gardens, one just a clutter of containers, sprouting beans, tomatoes, and flowers on a porch in Cabrini. There is more to these than good PR. They are a reminder that the tenants of CHA are good people. Mayor Burns' move to Cabrini showed that too, and it was great PR. Robinson has dismissed such a move as gimmicky, and he has every right to do so. The point is that 140,000 living, breathing, feeling people live in the CHA. Just ask me. October 9th, 1983. You can go homeward again. Although she had no way of knowing it at the time, the Hyde Park house that Leah bought and described in this column was to become a symbol of much that she hated about her life. She had originally hoped to fill in the 9-room prison constructed of my own hopes, as she called it in her generic suicide note, with happy babies and a husband. Instead, it remained a lonely place for her, largely empty of furniture, refurbished and family, a haunting house. Refurbishment and family, a haunting house. The Bridgeport neighborhood to which she refers at the end of the column was the all-white and Hispanic Southside home of the late Mayor Daley. It became a symbol of antagonism between whites and blacks as the mayor stood by idly when blacks who moved into the neighborhood were attacked and harassed into moving out. Similarly, Montclair is an all-white Northwest Side neighborhood. When the discount store on Broadway added an Afro hair products shelf, I took notice. When the Jewel at the Berwyn Avenue L stop sprouted bunches of fresh collard, mustard, and turnip greens, I made the best home-cooked meals ever. But when the 10-pound pails of chitterlings jutted out from the freezer at Treasure Island, the gourmet grocery, I knew it had happened. Integration truly has come to the North Side. Having done my part these 10 years for community relations, the time has come to move on, or rather to move back south. Despite Thomas Wolfe's admonition, the needs of aging parents beckoning me homeward to the South Side. A decade ago, I was a stranger in a strange land on the North Side. Like any real Chicago kid, I grew up not knowing about this great beyond. All I knew of the North Side is that that's what we passed through on the way to Riverview. Its existence wasn't verified until Christmas of 1962 when my dad and I drove to Montgomery Ward's main warehouse on Chicago Avenue to pick up my Barbie doll house. There it was spread out before me. the North Side, and it even had black people. Only in recent years, however, has it really helped black people. 10 years ago, to be black and to live North was pioneering. It was a perfect excuse to leave boring South Side parties early. Oh, you know, they have to drive all the way to the North Side, someone would say with sympathy and wonderment, and sometimes not with sympathy or wonderment, but contempt. Up there with those white folks was just as common a response. What a fine example of the isolationist city of neighborhoods mentally that afflicts all Chicagoans. I've gone from humble North Side pioneering in a cramped one bedroom in an 8-story imitation of a 4+1 on Wrightwood to a dilapidated but charming 2-flat graystone on Pine Grove. After saving my pennies, I became a grown-up, bought real furniture, and got a mortgage on a Sheridan Road condo with Woodbridge fireplace. After selling that, the next move was to a responsibility-free apartment at 3600 LSD, Lakeshore Drive, of course. And last, an Edgewater high-rise when Lakeview's ambiance and parking roulette just didn't seem worth it anymore. In 1970, before it was certified trendy, Lakeview actually had 986 blacks, according to the census. But then came the cry, "Northward, ho!" The wagon train rolled in, and now some 6,757 blacks reside in Lakeview. There have been similar results in Rogers Park, from 763 to 5,225, and in Edgewater from 373 to 6,514. Interestingly, the near North Side has lost 4,000 blacks, from 26,090 to 22,000, but the Cabrini Green outpost is secure. Soon the barriers may be broken on the Northwest Side. Even Jefferson Park has 5 blacks and Norwood Park 6, where there weren't any a decade ago. Montclair and Edison Park are the only holdouts citywide with 0. But I think the 52 in Edison Park in 1970 might have pulled up stakes to start the suburban expansion. Even on the Southwest Side, clearing at the city limits has maintained 5, and Chicago Lawn, where Marquette Park is located, has increased from 10 to 4,782. So, with the Northern Territory established, I retire to Hyde Park, where integration is a little older and little more comfy, where 90-year-old brick Victorians are still affordable, where you don't have to dress up just to go to the mailbox, where people who confess to being existentialists actually know what it means, and everyone white already knows about Afro hair products, greens, and chitterlings. Sorry, Bridgeport, although your black population declined from 79 to 39 during the last decade, and you could use some help, I've never lived more than a mile from the lake. Besides, Hyde Park is the new Bridgeport, with Harold Washington in residence. So goodbye, CTA. Hello, IC. Goodbye, indoor parking. Hello, street cleaner roulette. Goodbye, Belden corned beef. Hello, ribs and bibs. Goodbye, DePaul. Hello, U of C. Goodbye, miserable cubbies. Hello, winning White Sox. If it doesn't work out, there's always Montclair.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, all wrapped up. We will move forward after our exchange and pick up on the second audio segment. Folks have commentary they would like to share. Feel free to chime in. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to call in and you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. Should be linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. The address again, tinytiny.cc/oneRace. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link. It says free VOPE line. Click that link. Once you click the link, it will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. It will ask for the same number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom that will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us, and if you would like to participate, it is the same procedure. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. Once you do that, you'll hear the audio prompt to press the number 1. I'll see your hand. We'll get you on the screen, and you can feel free to share any commentary that you like. Again, we will be wrapping this book up next week, so definitely be having in mind major themes that you will take away from the book. Certainly anything that sticks out in terms of Black mental health, themes that you've seen throughout the book that relate to what led to her untimely suicide at the age of 32. But, you know, just keep that in mind as we prepare to wrap this all up next Friday. That's it. We will hit the phone lines. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. We should have Thomas in New York, our narrator for the week, caller in Michigan, Mr. Demery Poor, Roz, all four of you should be with us, and I'll look for other hands as I see them.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to all. Everyone on the line, this is Thomas Smith in New York. Yeah, I was listening to the reading, of course, and I have a few comments. Man, these dangerous white women. Mayor Jane Byrne, you know, the story goes that on an Easter Sunday, she decides to throw a carnival in Chicago's second largest and probably most notorious housing project, Greeny Green. Good Times is based on that housing project. And she tries to give a speech to boost the morale of the barbarian Negroes in the projects and to show the white people that the projects ain't that bad. But several thousand residents protested her. There's documentaries about this. I mean, just tackiness. You know, next to Clinton's signing his crime bill in the Robert Trailer houses, I mean, those two documentaries should be watched by everyone. Just tackiness. And you hear her voice over the protesters saying, but I bought a merry-go-round and a Ferris wheel. I mean, so this is why I say white women are so dangerous. She moves her family into the projects for a whole 3 weeks. I mean, just the mindset, just to show, just to prove that I guess she's not a race. I don't know. It's just. That's dangerous, okay? And, you know, there's several movies based on this. So I think one with, like, Billy Crystal or Dorito, where they play a slumlord and they have to move into the tenements. And it's just, you know, a spoof on the whole thing. But Chicago, you know, when I went to Chicago, man, their projects was a sight to be seen. I can only compare them like probably the Alphabet City or Co-op City in New York. But man, just huge. And you know, all these projects were built for white working class immigrants when they were initially built. And I think that she did a good job of displaying how, you know, they were able to move out after a generation, and have those good union jobs and be able to buy a house somewhere else in Chicago, whereas the blacks, due to racism, white supremacy, were unable to get those good jobs, so they weren't able to move up and move out. And they've been there for generation and generation, passing down the leash. You know, just the contrast of how, you know, all those immigrant class whites were able to just move out those housing projects after just, you know, maybe 20 years, and all the blacks stuck there for generation after generation. And she mentioned the white missionaries coming through the neighborhood. I mean, I was laughing when she said that, because I see the Mormons walk around here, you know, the Scientologists. No incidents, you know, they came to enlighten us, you know, but no one bothered them, you know. And lastly, mention of the almighty P-stones, you know, the pyramid stones, the El Rukins, you know, a Moorish gang. They even wore fez, not a do-rag, you know. And I don't advocate gangs, but when I look back at the history of Chicago gangs, you know, they were quite impressive. You know, they didn't start as criminal enterprises. You know, it was more like sort of pantherish. And, you know, that was pre-crack, of course. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you going to say something, Gus?
No, sir.
Oh, okay. Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to the narrator. Thank you for such a great reading of the text, Mr. Demery Four, all the callers and the listeners. I just first wanted to piggyback off of what Thomas in New York was just talking about with the mayor, Mayor Byrne, moving her family into the projects for 3 weeks. And it just really made me think of basically, like, she was like Tarzan, a female version of Tarzan, living amongst the niggas in the jungle, the concrete jungle. And it just goes to show again how white people, or one white person, one white family, can move in to our neighborhoods and be completely safe, even in a place where they would sniper shoot at police. Cabrini Greens was so notorious, even the police were terrified to go there. So that just really really stood out to me quite a bit. And also, to go back to the text itself, the first, because I kind of was not able to start at the beginning, so I went back. But I believe the first essay was Police and the Dynamics of Fear. And there's a section on page 134 where she writes, why was even the nearness of the police so dreaded? And why is such anxiety triggered automatically in the black community? Then came the warnings. The police might jump out and drag us from the car, take us in to be strip searched, charge us with all manner of crime, and it would be our word against theirs. The tale built into a thriller. And just the fact that she was asking questions like, why was even the nearness of the police so dreaded, and why was such anxiety triggered automatically in the black community, just speaks to her lack of knowledge of racism, white supremacy, in the sense that she didn't understand the origins of the police itself, simply because the police are agents of white supremacy. I remember you had Mr. Robert Williams, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he wrote a book called Police in the Black Community, and it was one of my favorite episodes because he really gave a lot of information regarding the jargon as far as the term patty rollers and how the patty rollers were basically slave catchers, and that term has been modified into the modern term patrollers, as in patrol cars, police, and it goes back to what Scotty Reed has talked about as far as police being modern-day slave catchers. So it really speaks to the fact that she didn't really understand the origins of the police and the fact that they were the original agents of racism, white supremacy. And then on the following page, she says, the environment in which the black community and police interact is like that of a prison. But many people refuse to draw this analogy because it is simpler to dismiss black behavior and endorse police behavior. Black people are just that way, the detractors would say, and be done with the topic. Cops are just that way, many in the black community would say, and with the same quickness and error. If blacks do not like to be painted in such a fashion, then it is unfair to do so to the police, who see the most horrid of what is already deplorable in every community. With this, within the psychological and socioeconomic prison that walls in a good part of the black community, everyone and everything foreign is an enemy. Now, the term foreign I took as non-white. I actually wrote in the word non-white to suggest that she didn't understand the system of white supremacy to really look at that for what it was, meaning anyone that's non-white in a community, in a white community, is the enemy, essentially. And anyone that's black in the black community being patrolled by the patty rollers, also known as police, are also the enemy. Also in that text, when she talks about, she says that many refuse to draw this analogy because it's simpler to dismiss black behavior and endorse police behavior. Again, speaks to a lack of understanding of the system, simply because we have been cordoned off in these neighborhoods that have been economically deprived in every other way possible. Also environmentally terrorized, like we're seeing with Flint, Michigan, basically every major city in the state of New Jersey and cities all across the country. And all of the behavior, all of the symptoms of racism, white supremacy is what breeds the negative behavior that black people exhibit. So again, it's a holistic misunderstanding of the system. And then she buys into the American understanding of reality as far as the white understanding of reality by trying to give the police a pass, saying that they deal with the worst of what's deplorable in every community. The only communities that are deplorable are non-white communities. White communities are not deplorable. White people are not treated the same way and on the same level as black people are. And again, it's just a really severe, handicapped understanding of the way that the system works that I see kind of inform some of what she said. And she was also partially accurate in the same reading when she describes the way in which the police and the black community interact is like that of a prison. So it's almost like, again, she understands certain things and it comes out almost like an innate understanding, and then she'll go back and almost double back on everything that she basically was expounding on that made sense. Also, there was, let me see. Oh yeah, the castration is legal essay. Justice by Castration is Disgusting essay. Really just brought home for me the fact that the legalized castration is just an ode to what was done to our ancestors when they were lynched, and it just gives them the opportunity to continue to do so using a legal precedent. Because if you look at even the whole ideology of sexual predators, none of that stuff existed until we encounter white people and racism, white supremacy. It is the sexual terrorism that has been visited upon our people for the last 500 years that has created these mental illnesses and sexual aggressive behaviors that we see in the form of people committing these types of rapes. Matter of fact, there were stories of this type of stuff happening all the way back on the slave ship. So really, it's a culmination of the sexual terrorism that is one of the core practices of racism, white supremacy, and it just gives them a legal precedent to do what they were doing with reckless abandon during the time of chattel slavery and the antebellum period when they would just lynch us with impunity. The section on Jeff Fort I found very, very fascinating. To me, he's a brilliant example of the fear that any powerful black man inflicts on the consciousness of white people, even though he applied his genius to quite a bit of negativity. It also reminds me of a documentary I saw, I believe it was Gangland, where they did an entire segment on the Arukan gang, and it was actually very fascinating. But I remember at one section they discussed the fact that Jeff Fort was actually in contact with Muammar Gaddafi. And at one point, he was trying to get money from Gaddafi. I think it was either $1 million that he was planning to, Gaddafi was potentially planning to give him. And then the CIA had found out that he also requested a rocket launcher, which they claim they believe he wanted to use to shoot down an American plane in Chicago. And that's when they really moved to, like, legally shut him down and really dismantle the gang in all of its former fashion. So if anybody can look that up or get a chance to see the Gangland episode on the El Rukins, I think that it's really fascinating as far as that the information that it provides. Then the section on home and family, where she writes on 141, people raise money to pay rent by selling baked goods or chicken dinners. Every Sunday morning, there was a parade of scrub Sunday school children, and every Sunday afternoon, there were white Bible students from Wheaton who came in without incident to nourish our souls and broaden our horizons. Wow. This section where she talks about people raising money by selling baked goods or chicken dinners kind of reminds me of a cousin of mine in Trinidad who actually does the same thing. Like, she used to take care of my grandmother, and she would actually sell food, curry dinners, and different types of Caribbean dishes out of the side of the house in order to help pay for different incidentals and sometimes different bills when they needed it. And then the severe form of white validation as far as these white Bible-toting students from Wheaton who came in, and she describes them without incident to nourish our souls and broaden our horizons. That is just one of the highest forms of white validation that I've seen throughout the book, simply because she's speaking of them in Jesus Christ-like terms. And then first she's saying without incident, so meaning that they were not racist, and then as well the black people behaved and did not assault them in any way, and then they're coming to nourish their souls and broaden their horizons. Wow, that was just really, really uncomfortable to read, simply because she just, again, the confusion abounds as far as her understanding of what it means to be white in the system of white supremacy. And, okay. Oh, the section on the tragedy of illegal abortion kind of reminded me of the documentary Ma'afa 21. I know you had the guy who actually made the documentary on the program, but I remember prior to abortion being legal, they said that actually white women, there was almost no illegal abortions performed in the black community. They were all performed in the white community, which is what generated the legalization of abortion in the first place. And then after abortion was legalized, the reverse took place, where massive numbers of non-white people and black women in particular were getting abortions, and the number of white women who were getting abortions plummeted. And it just really speaks to the concerted effort of white people to commit genocide. Like one of the guys in the documentary said, womb lynching, basically killing multiple generations of black people through the propagation of abortion. And it really just brings home the fact that the whole Planned Parenthood situation that's taking place now in politics, we really have a lot of work to do as far as bringing our consciousness over to a black self-respect mindset, like Dr. Wilson always talks about, simply because of the fact that we have been trained to utilize sex frivolously. And of course, we've now been acculturated to basically wiping out our own people. And I remember they said that there were more black people lynched in the womb, I mean, killed in the womb through abortion than all of the slaves that were killed on this continent. So it really speaks volumes to the sheer number of black people that we have lost. And then the section on page 187, a black man's discovery of dignity, I found really fascinating. She says, never seen so much interest in the nigger, is what they said after the young man was arrested, spat one policeman. Freed on a lesser charge and fined, he returned to work, and his life did not return to its usual monotony. His white coworkers, in all well-meaning and solicitousness, gave him a good preaching about knowing better than to go around beating up a white man. They secretly wondered whether this good-natured boy, they all liked so much. He was not anymore. And this really speaks to the fact of how white people function as, again, a racist white supremacist super organism, because the moment that they understood his arrest was for having a fight with a white man who basically disrespected his humanity, they immediately turned on him. They paid for this man's hospital bills, and immediately he became the dark terroristic nigger instead of the young black male that they worked with that was obviously had such a high level of character on the job. So it really just speaks to how they have the system set up for us to fall on our faces and lose everything with one mistake, whereas white people can rape people like Marv Albert, and he doesn't keep his job, but he got a new job a year later and is flourishing, whereas Mike Tyson, his life is just ruined. Finally, there was a section on 150 where she says, 10 years ago, to be black and live north was pioneering. I find that that term, for her to consider herself pioneering, is almost like a form of white validation to live in this white neighborhood. And I don't see what's pioneering about living amongst the most xenophobic, terroristic beings on the planet, because that's essentially what she did by moving amongst white people in the North, even though I'm sure it was for safety reasons as well, but their neighborhoods are better than ours as far as the way that they're taken care of. So that kind of stood out as a form of white validation. And also, there's a brief section beneath that where she says, and sometimes not with sympathy and wonderment, but contempt up there with those white folks, just as a common response, which was just as common a response, excuse me. What a fine example of the isolationist city of neighborhoods mentality that afflicts all Chicagoans. Again, that speaks to black folks who, again, I think of another form of anti-blackness in which she's speaking of black people that were jealous of her living up there with those white folks. And it kind of reminds me of my wife, because she grew up in Central Jersey. She's been around to different, she did like different debutante events and things like that, where she was around a lot of white females. And she always told me stories of when she was in high school, because she had to go to these events and she was around white people, she would get the same sort of conversation from black students in the school. There you go with those white girls. And they would actually be jealous that she got some sort of quote-unquote positive attention from these white people who were in the same debutante arena as my wife was. And it just kind of reminds me of that whole idea of white people validating us as people, as human beings, and that psychological effect that it has on us as far as us worshiping them as people. And the isolationist city of neighborhoods mentality, it's really just normal American behavior. We naturally segregate ourselves because we understand on a subconscious level how racism, white supremacy functions, and the fact that to be around white people is to be in danger. Even though we may not consciously admit that, that's obviously for black people, I think, why we do have that isolationist mentality. Thank you, and I'll mute my line there.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to Roz and Thomas in New York and any of the other callers. I first want to comment on the police and the dynamics of fear. On page 134, it said it doesn't require analytical training to connect the dynamics in the emotions of paranoia and aggressiveness directed at police in cities hundreds of miles apart, or to wonder why they are so spontaneous. But understanding them requires more than the easy explanation of racism, even when all white juries, as in Miami, may deserve condemnation. These emotions are aimed daily at whoever is in uniform, and so black officers get it as much, if not more, because they often are seen as traitorous. You know, here she goes using the word racism as an explanation to what a non-white person is feeling or doing, and that is incorrect. We know that non-white people cannot be racist. And then that part about black officers get it as much, if not more, because they're often seen as traitorous. Black police officers were forced to form their own unions because of racism, and they experienced racism in the police force as well as non-whites outside of the police force. But then saying that that racism has nothing to do with it is really absurd. And then one other thing in that particular article, as society would keep this culture generally out of its sight and mind, so it wants no more of the police or the black community's tale. And when this untidiness encroaches upon the conscience of civilized society, in riots, mugshots, in newspapers, front pages, or worse, in crimes committed in the civilized zone, even then, the command to police is to get the problem corralled, get it out of sight again. There's no thought of what could be done about such conditions or behavior. And I suspect that white people knew what the results would be of stacking thousands of poor black people on top of each other, and purposely created these conditions to contain and to further mistreat people of color. Imagine three generations of family trapped in the projects. And I want to say something briefly about the rapes on the justice by incarceration. Actually, you had, you know, two rapes here. One, the New Bedford, Massachusetts rape, you know, where these men of Portuguese descent, which probably can be mistaken for white men or are white men. None of them got over 12 years. And that incident was portrayed in a 1988 movie called Suspect, I believe, with Jodie Foster, and which was loosely based on what had happened. But those men, you know, was treated entirely different because they even blamed the victim, saying that maybe she was suggestive in some way, as opposed to the rape that occurred in South Carolina, where the three young men committed a rape in a motel, and the judge wanted to castrate them. You know, and we got this same mentality, like Roz pointed out, you know, as, you know, it was back in slavery day. Castration and lynching and just killing, murdering blacks used to terrorize as to cause fear as a means of control. And then Jeff Ford can't be rewritten. It was interesting, him being the founder of the Black Peace Stone Rangers on the South Side. But in 1983, when she wrote the article, he had only been given 13 years behind conspiracy to distribute cocaine, but eventually ended up being sentenced to 155 years in prison. And, you know, it just, it's disgusting, really, that, you know, she would compare Jeff Fort with Al Capone. I mean, Al Capone, with his bootlegging business and controlling the mayor and the Chicago police, you know, I doubt if he, Al Capone, ever qualified as a socially and community conscious individual at a young age. And briefly, on her home and family, I believe she made some reference to white kids coming over to see where she lived in the projects, which goes to show that she was hanging with whites. And when the mayor, Jane Byrne, moved into the projects, I think that that was an act of racism. Not only was it temporary, but it didn't do anything to improve the conditions of the permanent residents. And then later, when blacks were trying to move into this Bridgeport area, she did nothing to assist them, you know, from being attacked and driven out of those neighborhoods. And the part about the rape, you know, I want to tie this in. It's school teacher Brianna Alty is accused of four counts of rape on teenage boys in school right now. She faces 3 to 25. You know, we have a disparity in our justice system. You know, so if it's 30 years for rape, then it should be 30 years, you know, for white females also when they commit the crime. Like I always say, they are the most under-prosecuted members of society. And I'll mute my line on that. I won't touch the abortion issue, but I'll give somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
For sure, for sure. Our narrator, caller in Michigan, if you had any comments you wanted to get in, or other folks, if you have comments, views you want to share, just *6, we'll get you in as well. Narrator, any commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers and listeners. Just a few notes I wanted to expound on. The police dynamics, that first article, when I was reading that, and she was sharing the shooting death of, I think it was Nevelle Johnson, by policeman Luis Alvarez. It just confirms the killing of black men by these race soldiers is business as usual. And for me, honestly, I had never heard of this shooting. And I'm seeing more and more how, you know, our protests, our riots, our demonstrations, all the things that we are doing as a reaction to this mistreatment, it means nothing to the racists. Because to hear about this shooting and the things that they were doing, it hasn't changed. And so I think about the Tamir Rice's, the Mike Browns, and all the people that, you know, since then, you know, even in Detroit, there was a case with Malice Green. He was killed by police, and it was a lot of demonstrations. But as time go on, it's just, you know, another name and until the next incident. And so it was just heart-wrenching just to hear, you know, how this name, this person, you know, it was just business as usual in this system. So I did appreciate her, you know, writing that and having the opportunity just to know about this case. And even with, like, now, we have the ability to, you know, with video record our smartphones, all of these police shootings are, like, in our face. Like, back then, there weren't the ability to record all this. And even with us seeing some of the mistreatment with our, you know, with the video recording, it doesn't change anything. They don't care. So it was just interesting reading that. Another thing that I made notation of was I did appreciate her tribute to her father by telling his story. I think many of us really understands more what it means to be non-white in the system. The more and more when we hear stories from our parents, our grandparents, and our great-grandparents. I listened to, because of this show and this program, that's how I found out about The Warmth of the Suns. And I talk about that book, and it just kind of really, after reading that book and, you know, finding out about it in the archives, it just kind of changed my perspective on really appreciating our stories. And so even in my family, I'm always pulling, you know, from my great aunts and uncles, just the stories of, you know, the migration that they had and how we ended up in Detroit and all of the things that I wouldn't normally ask had I not really understood and appreciated just knowing our true, you know, history. So it really had an impact on me, and I'm glad that she shared that part of her story. I also made note of how in that story, how they just, you know, took the $10 out of her father's paycheck to pay the doctor bill of the white boy that he got into the altercation with. So I thought that was just fascinating. And lastly, before I mute myself, I did want to say that the way you started the program with Mr. Fuller's statement, the dialogue between you two, I think that was very appropriate. So I'm seeing more and more that working with white people is indeed a tragic arrangement, because we spend the majority of our day with white people when you're in that work environment, and it's so confusing. They'll give us a title, Again, we think we're free, but in essence, we're really not. And so the titles and just thinking that we have the same rights as white people, it confuses us. And again, I think it's a tragic arrangement, just like, you know, being in relationships. So I just wanted to add that bit, and I'll mute my line.
Indeed, indeed. A caller, a retired firefighter in Florida, is with us. I think I might be willing to put a nickel or two down that he has mentioned some of these incidents that happened in Miami in the early 80s around these shootings. I think he has brought these up before. Before I nab his call, just for extra context, the crisis, I always talk about the importance of black journalists. Kevin Moss, he wrote a report. This is from January 1983, so this is like a few weeks after this quote-unquote riot, the uprisings in Miami, after this race soldier was exonerated. I'm just going to read a little bit, and then we'll get our caller in Florida. So this report is, Arthur McDuffie's ghost still haunts racial injustice in Miami. Tuesday, December 28, 1982, in a rundown black neighborhood called Overtown in Miami, a black youth lay fatally wounded by a policeman's bullet. Following the shooting of 20-year-old Neville Johnson, Jr., hundreds of black people raged through the streets, throwing rocks, burning cars, and sporadically looting. Angered and frustrated, they tore through the Overtown area. Many black-owned businesses were among those victimized. I have heard that pattern before. 3 days of urban unrest resulted in over 28 injured people, 38 arrests, and a second death. This death, according to the Miami Police Department, the result of an attempt to loot a frozen food warehouse, occurred when a black youth was shot by a police officer. The youth allegedly pointed a gun at the officer. Nightmares of Miami in 1980 seemed to return with this new series of disturbances. The disturbances bring to light the same concerns that rocked Miami in 1980. Dismal relations between the black community and Miami police may be an underlying cause of the problem. Two Hispanic officers, Luis Alvarez, 32, and Luis Cruz, 21, were patrolling the Latin area of Miami when they decided to leave their patrol and enter the Overtown area. According to Sergeant Jack Sullivan of the Miami Police Department, it was a violation of police procedure to leave a patrol unless ordered by superiors or in an emergency. Black City Manager Howard Gary also stated that Alvarez and Cruz violated police procedure by leaving their assigned patrol in a predominantly Latin area of Miami and going to Overtown. But Angelo Batistas of the Miami Police's Office of Public Affairs stated on the telephone that police patrols normally enter adjacent areas and that this is not against police policy. According to police reports, Alvarez and Cruz entered an Overtown video game arcade known for its drug traffic. Alvarez asked Johnson about a suspicious bulge under his shirt. Johnson allegedly replied that it was a gun. At this point, according to Police Chief Kenneth Harms, the officer placed his left hand on the gun and with his right hand drew his own revolver. Johnson allegedly made a sudden move, and Alvarez fired his .38 police revolver point-blank into Johnson's face. Johnson lay in a coma 24 hours before he died. I will stop there. Just you have a little bit more information about the first article that Ms. McClain wrote about. And the section that I just read, it has a picture of Neville Johnson's family. His father and grandmother are all there. His mother as well at his funeral. Not that you need to see any more photos, images. I think we've seen enough of this throughout the duration of racism, white supremacy. But you can read the whole report if you are so inclined. It is The Crisis. The author is Kevin Moss, and the title again is Arthur McDuffie's Ghost Still Haunts Racial Injustice in Miami. Retired firefighter in Florida, did you have any commentary?
Yes, sir. Greetings to the callers, Gus. Yeah, I was going to briefly speak on that. I kind of like was paying attention to the program off and on. I had some other things that I had to get accomplished, and but I did hear the Alvarez rebellion as what I think has been mentioned. it's just something, it's just a product of this global system of racism and white supremacy, where it repeats itself over and over and over and over and over and over again. And during that time in South Florida, Miami-Dade County, to be exact, it was a series of similar situations, starting in 1980 with Arthur McDuffie, former Marine. Basically came out of the Marine Corps. Transitioned his work ethic and everything else that he learned from going up into a insurance company business, and subsequently was murdered by the police, beaten to death, literally beaten to death. In other words, they didn't fully accomplish it in Los Angeles in 1992, but with Mr. McDuffie, they did accomplish it. And in turn, rebellions. I wasn't on the fire department during that time, 1980, but I was in and around the Liberty City area at the time when that was occurring, because my father basically was a barber in that area. And with the Alvarez situation, I was on the fire department, and it was a series. It was serious during the time when I was early in my career on the fire department, where rebellions was taking place about once every year, and all subsequently the ones that I've heard since then, and also from studying history before, they all had the same common occurrence over and over and over and over again, as far as the actions of white people who choose to practice racism. It doesn't matter on what their surname is. It can be a so-called English last name or a Spanish last name in this case. Our behavior and / actions generally are the same also. And then business goes back to usual. Just some thoughts on it. Overtown, you may not know about, but Overtown used to be South Beach. Probably most people that are hearing me heard of South Beach because of this high-level entertainment that gets all over the world as far as where to come. Overtown at one time, because black people couldn't go to Miami Beach for a long period of time, and the all of the entertainers, especially the well-known, globally known non-white black entertainers, after performing on the beach because they couldn't stay there, they would perform in the Overtown area. And also Overtown had a high level of black businesses, quote unquote, functioning in that light. And in turn, it was all destroyed by the usual suspects ultimately over time. And so basically, because I haven't really been paying, had the opportunity to pay attention to the book read, that's basically what I did hear that part. And just giving some background experiences that I had, because as a firefighter and as an activist, I would be on duty, and they would, certain things that we would be doing during that period of time. And then off duty, I would be involved with non-white people who were basically either protesting on the subject matter or trying to say or do something that would give attention to the system of racism and white supremacy. Matter of fact, there's a photograph of me that was taken, that's put in Jet magazines of myself and several other people carrying a symbolic casket of one of the non-white black victims through the Overtown area. But that's basically all I have to say right now. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. I'll nab in a few comments, some of the things I had, then we'll see if anybody else has any comments they want to get in. We have the second audio segment this week is a wee bit shorter than we would normally have. It could have been, the typical length is about 30 minutes, but we are almost at the end of the book. If I had done the normal length, then next week would be really, really short. I don't even know if we'd have an hour of reading for next week, but this way, next week we'll be about the normal length, might be a little bit shorter, but either way, we'll be wrapped up next week. Anywho, the first report, the police and the dynamics of fear, that's the first one that we read this week. This is roughly 2 months before her suicide. I found it fascinating just with everything that's been happening contemporary since throughout racism, white supremacy, but especially since there's been so much focus over the last 2 years on police terrorism of black people in this area of the world and even globally in some regards. I was just telling one of our listeners in Canada, they were focused on Black Lives Matter in Toronto and what they're trying to do. I think they just had major protests this week where they were camped out in front of the police station and some of the other major buildings in terms of government structures in the city of Toronto. And she was asking my thoughts, and I was saying, you know, I really don't pay attention. That's not something that I really focus a lot of attention on in terms of when a black person, non-white person is killed or mauled by police, because that happens so frequently. And I've just concluded as a retired firefighter just said, that's just a product of white supremacy. As long as you have white supremacy, that is going to happen, and it's nothing that can be done to stop that, that all of the strategies, protesting, rioting, whatever else, you know, people can think of, boycotting, marching, even counter violence, killing enforcement officials, all of that has been tried for decades, and it has not solved the problem at all. And I would say you can just, if you do a study, I thought it was great to get this essay, but I mean, you can go, how many, just depends on how far back you want to go. I've heard Mr. Fuller talk about this. You can go back 100 years or more. Just depends on how far back you want to go, and you will see tons of these. Matter of fact, I read that report from the crisis. You can go back in the crisis archives, early 1900s, and you will see the exact same thing. Pick a city where you have a high population of black people and police have mauled Negro child, 18 years old, blah, blah, blah. They, you know, flip out. This is in Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man, where he wrote that book. It's almost 70 some years old at this point, where that's one of the climaxes. The police in New York have killed a black person. That's just part and parcel with the system of white supremacy. I thought it was fascinating. I think Roz and some of the other callers touched on that, where she's talking about she couldn't believe, or some of the black people that she was riding with said they couldn't believe that she pulled up so close to a police car, that they could be terrorized, dragged out, and mauled, and all of that. She's writing, this is during the time of John Burge in Chicago. She used the term terrorized later on in the book, referencing other black people. I don't think I've heard her use the term terrorism or terrorize in reference to whites and what they do to black people. If you want to talk about terrorist John Burge, you should put his picture there. Chicago Police Department. You want to talk about a gang? She talked about Jeff Ford. Chicago Police Department. That is a gang. I've been saying for weeks now, the Verdoliak 29. That is a gang where you have white people that can go and obstruct what the mayor is doing, where you have white people that can go out as a unit, an armed government body, Chicago Police Department, and deliberately target black people and do this with impunity for years. Castration pliers and everything else that they were doing. That is amazing that this is happening at the time she wrote this article. And it's still the same major theme that I've been pointing out for weeks now, where it's got to be even-handed. You know, we can't paint the police with this broad brushstroke and just say that this is what they do. It's just racism that they just go out and maul black people, because then you have other people come back and say, oh, it's just, you know, the niggers are unruly and they're criminal and it's black on black crime. That, you know, if black people don't want to be painted with that sort of broad brushstroke, then it would be incorrect to speak that way about the police. And in my view, that I think is a part of the mental illness of racism, white supremacy that impacts all of us. Again, this was 2 months before her suicide. And I would say, again, now some of this could be
her white identification. She had white great-grandparents, and I think there's been a lot of that you all have already touched on, but I also think some of this could be her editors, even if they're not doing it directly, where she is self-editing, knowing that this is going to be going to white people, got to approve what's going to be printed in their paper. There's going to be a lot of white people reading what she is writing. She wrote this piece after the Chicago Hates White People. Some of that could be in that effort to make sure that she doesn't rile up white people too much about what she is writing. I think she was only the first black person with the Chicago editorial board. But just this consistent pattern of, I got to be even-handed, I got to be balanced, I can't just make it seem like that I am correctly attributing blame, the people who are most to blame, with whites. John Burge and the other whites in Chicago that are most responsible for this whole dynamic. And certainly, if we're going to talk about crime in Chicago, I was reminded of Beryl Satter. She was on the program. We discussed her book, Family Property, where she documents her father and white people in Chicago for decades knew exactly what they were doing. That's exactly what she called it, too. Terrorizing black people, economic terrorism, to make sure that they didn't have access to quality resources, quality housing. And they know, you stack people up in this environment and keep them there for decades on end, you know it's going to be crime and the people are going to become self-destructive. They already know that. And we don't care. That's what we want to happen. They're black people. Who cares? Next, let's see. I thought it was interesting as well when she had the paragraph about that black police officers are subjected to the same sort of mistreatment, that you can't just chalk it up to racism. And in my view, I would say that's another one where it could be an effort to be, quote unquote, even-handed, or an effort to come away from just making an accurate, in my view, indictment of whites, where she might be accused, oh, you're generalizing and just trying to say that all whites are racist, moving away from, is that true? Where she says this about black people, where it's, these black enforcement officers, they are not going to the Gold Coast and white enclaves in Chicago and mistreating and terrorizing black people. These black, even black enforcement officers, they are still under the system of racism, white supremacy. We had a former black Chicago police officer on the program, and she talked about that for 2.5 hours on the program, how she was with her white colleagues, fellow Chicago police officers, and she was nervous that they might do something to her. She was talking about going into meetings and having her hand on her gun, literally, not knowing if this was going to be a shootout and dealing with these race soldiers herself. Just in my view, just not being accurate about what it is, racism, white supremacy, and again, reflective of the title of the book, A Foot in Each World. The next piece, Justice by Castration, I thought you all had great commentary on it. The only thing I would add, I would support that if they were going to castrate or whatever other tortures or punishment that they were going to come up with for people who rape, sexually molest other people. I would be totally in support of that, but I know it's not going to be applied correctly under a system of racism, white supremacy. It will not be Daniel Holtzclaw who is castrated, sterilized, or whatever other punishments they come up with. I already know that this is going to be applied in a white supremacist manner, that whites, when they go out and sexually terrorize, molest, rape black people, black children, males, females, they're not going to be subjected to this. They're going to get the best lawyers. It's not going to be Jerry Sandusky who gets subjected to these sorts of crimes. And the other side of that, I also remember books like Picking Cotton, where you have a long history of white people who have falsely accused black people of all sorts of sexual crimes, that I think you would have a whole lot of black people being subjected to this sort of a barbarous punishment. And then after you have already done the damage, whoops, falsely identified Timothy Cole down in Texas, whoops, got the wrong one, DNA exoneration. Nothing we can do about it now, though. Sorry. That's the type of thing that I would expect under their system. Where she says, where she's writing about Jeff Ford. Again, this is why I just keep emphasizing with the way that we use terms, just the way that we think about a gang. We don't think about Edward Verdoliak as a gang. We don't think about John Burge, the Chicago Police Department, as a gang. We don't think about the white race as a gang. It's very quick, very easy. It's almost a reflex. Of course, Jeff Ford. Of course, Jeff Ford, he's a gangster. He's a terrorist. He terrorizes black people in the area, and we should not be trying to rewrite him or talk about him in some other manner. I think I consistently talk about metaphors when we make analogies or what have you at the end of that piece when she says that he should be compared to Al Capone. Al Capone, it's well documented. This guy was going and throwing white elected officials downstairs, mauling and abusing them if they didn't do what he wanted. I've never heard anyone say that Jeff Ford was going and doing this sort of thing, that he didn't agree with what Jane Byrne was doing or Mayor Daley was doing, and so he went and roughed them up, or any of these council members, Edward Burke, Edward Verdoliak, going and smacking them around and telling them, you need to do right by black people. If you don't do what I want you to do, we're going to make you pay. And that, I never have heard that sort of thing. It's easy for black people, and whites will allow you to mistreat other black people, other victims of racism. If you're really a gangster, whatever, we'll dominate the whole city of Chicago. Those are gangsters, and in my opinion, the biggest gang on the planet, Chicago, worldwide, it's white people, hands down, no comparison. Everybody else, junior league, as Mr. Fuller has said, but I thought that was real significant. And again, that might be the sort of thing where whites require her to write a piece like this. If you're going to be on the editorial board, particularly if you're going to be talking about race, this will appease whites. If you write this piece talking about Jeff Ford and he can't be rewritten, comparing him to Al Capone, that sort of thing. On page 140, I thought it was significant. This is in the section Home and Family. The very first paragraph. Now, this is her former husband, Clarence Page. So this is not the words of Ms. McLean, but where he says Leonita McLean was a public housing project. Home to Leonita McLean was a public housing project on Chicago's South Side. Her family was an African-American lineage and mixed lightly with European white and Native American Indian genes, a legacy of the slavery years that is not uncharacteristic of black American families. Again, in my view, if we were going to be accurate, this is not a lineage mixed lightly with European white. That is, to put it mildly, being euphemistic, I would say. I mean, if we're really being accurate, this is rape. If we want to talk about the castration piece, this is what we're talking about. Rape is how this happened. Go back to the book that we just had when we had the sublets on the program, The American Slave Coast. This was centuries of deliberate, required rape of black people, and we just don't talk about it in these accurate terms. Sometimes it even gets glorified as some sort of romance or, you know, this was a great thing that happened here. Moving forward to some of the other pieces, I had the same thing underlined at the bottom of 141 and going over to 142, where she says every Sunday morning there was a parade of scrubbed Sunday school children, and every Sunday afternoon there was a white Bible students from Wheaton who came in without incident to nourish our souls and broaden our horizons. The white identification, super strong. White validation, super strong. And again, this is mental illness. This is the sort of thing, in my view, that is giving you some of the further things to understand what led to her committing suicide at the age of 32, in my view. I could be incorrect, but I think this sort of thing is huge. And even before you get to the white invaders coming in with the religion of white supremacy, just this part about being scrubbed up on Sunday for their best. James Baldwin, because you've talked about him earlier in the book, he has a passage, and I think it's in the book that she mentioned, Evidence of Things Not Seen, where he talks about black people being obsessively clean because white people had done so much to degrade our black self-respect and make us think that there was something inferior or defective about us, that we had to be super polished, super clean, super scrubbed if we were going to go out, particularly if it was going to be something where you have in contact with whites, to make them say, oh, they're human. They're not niggers. Maybe we should treat them correctly. In my view, I see some of that where the Sabbath, white Jesus's day, them being super scrubbed and cleaned. I see some of that there, but certainly these white invaders coming in, it just seems like there's this reverence for contact with whites. White people are willing to be around us. Oh, joy. White people are allowing us to move through their neighborhood. Oh, joy. This is wonderful. This is great. We're making progress. And it seems like a lot of us, not in the 1980s when she's writing, right now, 2016, have that same way of thinking. If whites are willing to be around us, if whites are voting for President Obama, anything that suggests that whites think of us a little bit better, that is just joyous. And that is, nothing could be further from the truth. Even that comment about Jane Byrne and her being willing to come in to the neighborhood, that sort of tacky racist antic, it is very, very common, even right up today, 2016, where you have white elected officials where they will do the same sort of thing, where they'll say, hey, I will live on food stamps for the next week or 2 weeks. I think Senator Cory Booker in New Jersey. I think he had some sort of running dialogue where he was going to do this. I think he actually did this for a number of days, saying he was going to live on food stamps or whatever the allocation that you get, the amount of money that you get for TANF or welfare, that he was going to do it to see, you know, how difficult it is, and let's make changes for these sort of policies. Even though he's a non-white person, this is common. It's just political spectacle, political theater for them to have a little bit of fun with the Negras. I can empathize with you all. I know how tough it is. I'm going to change these policies. I'm willing to come down in the muck and see how tough you have it, when nothing could be further from the truth. They're not going to change these policies. Whites could correct this with the snap of a finger. They have no interest in doing this. Let's see, the piece. I was going to say about the piece on abortion, because there's a lot being talked about that right now. I want to make sure I get in the segment on 142. On 142, where she says, where she's talking about being in the ghetto and it was not looked at as a bad thing. Previously, where it wasn't something, I guess, to be ashamed of, where she says, by the late 60s, but the late 60s arrived and made being lower income, not poor, almost noble, especially for those making progress to better their lives. And college, having come from the projects, was a great conversation starter. You actually live in the projects? How many roaches do you own? Carloads of white classmates shuttled in to take a look at a real live housing project. I found that passage disturbing on so many levels. Again, to what I had said before, white validation, white identification. These, and I mean, it's almost like going to the zoo, it seems, the way that these whites were talking. And I believe her that this sort of thing happened. Like, oh, this nigga lives in the ghetto. Let's go see where she lived. And I mean, whites do this sort of thing. I've talked about this before, where you have projects like Todd Lending. He's a white man in Chicago. He did a documentary film called Legacy, where they went to Chicago and hung out with these black people for a long time to view their life and what have you. I think within the first 24 hours of them going there, this young black child gets shot and killed, and oh, it's terrible, and look at the Negro suffering, and they just stay and film all their misery. Whites do this sort of thing. It's just having a blast and going to mock black suffering, black misery. I've said this for a long time, that this is almost like a genre of film and entertainment now for whites to enjoy the suffering of black people. But that whole passage, and it didn't seem like that was her reading, her understanding of this at all. For her, it seemed like, oh, wow, this is a great, great way where I am relating to whites that I don't think of as racist. I think that they are just intrigued. They're learning. This is new. We're sharing. This is great. I'm having a great time with these whites who are not racist, which, again, I just, mental illness. Mental illness. It affects all of us. System of racism, white supremacy. I see a lot of this even now. Let's see. The last thing I'll get in the passage on 150, or I guess two things I'll get in on 149. This is the essay 149. This is the essay about the CHA, my alma mater, where she talks about growing up the Chicago Housing Authority, where she says they could maybe have an experiment. It's time for someone to just try one grand social experiment, to come up with money to relocate just one building of folks from Taylor or Cabrini Green into existing low rises or rehabbed six flats, and find some hospital, school, skills center, or other organization or institution to use all or part of an empty building. If it doesn't work, at least it will have been tried. Whites already have the information on this. They know that if you concentrate a high concentration of people, it doesn't matter if they're black, white, whatever. If you concentrate a high number of people who have nothing, no resources, thanks to racists, they already know this is going to be a terrible environment. And if you move these people out into an area where there's a lower concentration of poverty, they will do much, much better. They already have the data on this. This is not rocket scientists. They know this. They're just not interested in helping black people. They are dedicated to racism, white supremacy. And I think sometimes we just have difficulty understanding, believing that that's what it is. The other thing I'll get in, and then we had another person that had hand up as well, where on 150, this is the essay, You Can Go Homeward Again. She says, she's talking about, she didn't know anything about the North Side. And again, this whole essay about, you know, moving and having greater proximity to white people, She wrote this essay just for the date stamp. This is October 9th, 1983, so this is about 7-8 months before her unfortunate suicide. But the portion where she says, "A decade ago, I was a stranger in a strange land on the north side. Like any real Chicago kid, I grew up not knowing about this great beyond. All I knew of the north side is that that's what we passed through on the way to Riverview. Its existence wasn't verified until Christmas of 1962, when my dad and I drove to Montgomery Ward's main warehouse on Chicago Avenue to pick up my Barbie doll house. There it was spread out before me, the north side, and it even had black people." Just, I mean, that whole little paragraph encompasses so much of the brutality, really the psychological terrorism that is inflicted on us from such a young age. This, it's almost like heaven. If people, if you've been listening to our book club for a long time, when we had that segment on The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison, which is one of my favorite books all time, top five, she has this segment where they are walking to the white neighborhood where this is Pecola, a young black girl. She's with her friend. They're walking to where her mom works at. And this is the white part of town. And it's this, it's like, oh my God, the earth has changed. The sun is brighter. The trees are bigger. The air smells better. Just everything has changed. And she describes it so vividly. This reminds me of the exact same thing. Like, I get to go to this other side of town where the white people live for Christmas. Now it's connected to white Jesus and the major holiday of the year. I'm getting my gift. I doubt very seriously that in 1962 she was going to get a black Barbie doll. I might be in error about that, but I'd be willing to bet a sizable chunk of funds that the big to-do 1962 as a young child going with her black father to get a white Barbie doll on the white side of town for white Jesus's birthday. Wow, that is the psychological programming that leads to white people are the greatest. Got to be around white people. Let's live around. I want to live here too. This is great. All of that is tied up in terms of our programming and the psychosis that we have to work through. That's why I say it's always great if you can get this information at a young age so you never get started with the holidays and the dolls and all of that that just contributes to not understanding what it means to be white and not functioning with them correctly. That leads to all of the heartache, all of the, oh man, they're racist. I'm so upset about all of this. I'm so hurt that they don't accept me. What can I do to be accepted? What can I do to have white Barbie and white Ken accept me as an equal? And just not understanding that that is not what this is about at all. You are a nigger forever. I was going to say something about the essay she wrote about her dad, but I will stop there. The person that dialed in from a block number, did you have commentary you wanted to get in also? You should be with us. Person that dialed in from a block number, did you have commentary? Yes, no?
I'm just listening, sorry.
No apologies. I find it hard to believe you heard all that and have no commentary, but all right. Since, as I said, the second audio segment is short today, so if folks have any other comments, they can do that, and since it's short, I will get in my comment about the essay she wrote about her dad. Our narrator, she referenced the, and this is from February, Black History Month, no less, February 1983, A Man's Discovery of Dignity, in referencing Warmth of Other Suns. So important. I talk about this all the time. People talking about how can you inform your children about racism. Man, talk to your grandparents, aunts, uncles, even if they're family friends, if they're older, if they are over 65, talk to them. Get them to talk about some of their experiences, things that they saw, things that their parents told them. They can, I mean, wow, that can make it extremely clear what racism, white supremacy is. And I suspect that that sort of thing will have such a greater impact, not just seeing this on television or reading in a book, but being able to talk to someone that you are related to, that you have a relation, a living relationship with, to have them tell you about some of the things that whites have done to them. Man, it is so powerful. Take advantage. I felt a lot of ways about this essay. I'm so glad that she wrote it. I'm so glad that she shared this story. I'm not sure who her intended audience was. I'd be very curious to hear how whites responded to this essay, like what the sort of feedback. It would be great if it was like now where you have this essay online, and so then you could go and see what comments people wrote, white and non-white, about this essay. I'm so glad she shared it. The part where they took the money out of his paycheck, I just go back to what I said again, that is gangster. Where you can just jack somebody's paycheck, they don't have a say-so about it. Oh, we just took the money out, nigga. Somebody's got to pay this white man's medical bill. You put your, who do you think you are to put your hands on a white man? Of course we took the money out of your check to pay this white man's. That's gangster. I don't think Jeff Ford or any other black person has that type of power to go to a white person and just take money out of their check and say, well, you did this, Daniel Holzkopf. We just took this money out of your check to hook up some of the victims that you mauled and raped over the years in Oklahoma. Money just gone. I don't think any black person has that type of power. Maybe I'm in error. The other thing that stood out about this essay, this response to being called, and even it, Mr. Fuller was mentioned, the essay is called A Man's Discovery of Dignity. Every time I hear that word in talking about black people's response to racism, white supremacy, I hear Mr. Fuller where he says, what's the difference between a dignified slave and a slave that's silly? He says one is dignified, one is silly. He says that every time someone brings up dignity with regards to black people victims of white supremacy. And this is kind of the same thing that I have. Any sort of responses, even what we talked last week, anytime where you have to put your hands on a white person, oh man, like having the understanding this could be your last day on earth. Now, if you deem that it's worthy, a white person has called you nigger and that's worth dying on the spot right now, fine, that's your choice. VGQ, cool in the gang. However, your dignity was taken, quote unquote, whatever that means. Your dignity was taken before you were even born in the system of white supremacy. Being called a nigger, that's just, you know, violation number 8,029,000. You know, more coming. If you deem that that's worthy of fighting and being willing to die right now, fine. But I would stand by what I said last week. Anytime you put your hands on a white person, that should be the foremost thought in your mind. I'm ready to die right now, because that's exactly what could happen. Exactly what happened in this incident, which seems like this was years ago. I don't see a date for this. She has the date when 1929, when her dad left, but I don't really see a date on when this brawl happened on the train. But this exact sort of thing could happen right now, 2016. The only exception, the only wrinkle that I would see would be maybe they don't take the money out of your check. Maybe you just get fired off the jump. That's about the only change that I see would happen. You touch this white man, the police come, they beat you up, they blame everything on you, you get charged, you lose your job, and this is going to follow you for the rest of your life. That's about what I would expect to happen right now, 2016, and as long as the system of white supremacy exists. In my view, because I see the same sort of thing happen, the black male in California, Christopher Dorner, he had the same sort of reaction. He wrote about it in his alleged manifesto, where a white person called him a nigger on the police force and he was ready to fight and got in trouble for this and that sort of thing. Whites are going to win every time if that's the response that you have. They're going to win every time. You putting your hands on a white person, he called me a nigger, she called me a nigger, so I got to put my hands on him. I would say 10 times out of 9. The police are going to come and you're going to be the one that gets in the most trouble. I would not encourage fighting about dignity. It's not, even though I was glad that she shared this, and I guess some people could view this as black self-respect, I just view this, whites already know, we got them. All we got to do is call them a nigger. They're going to have their emotional reaction. As they say, they will chimp out, and then we will just Voltron and do what we do as an organized white gang and make things terrible for them for the rest of their life as a result of this incident, where they think, you're not going to talk to me, you're not going to diss me, who do you think you're talking to like that, blah, blah, blah. We already got that response, no problem. And we have demonstrated how we're going to respond to this sort of thing for centuries. And I will stop there. Anybody else have comments they wanted to get in?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, yes, sir. I just wanted to briefly expand a little bit more on what I don't think that she may have included about Jeff Fort. The Black Panther Party, was gaining some attention and influence out of other non-white black youth at the time. For instance, our Prentice Bunchy Carter, who had a great deal of influence over a whole lot of other normally black young people, black males especially, of a so-called gang that was called the Slawson Gang. He immediately brought himself and his influence with those young people into the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles. And in turn, Jeff Fort, as I did think I heard, had a great deal of influence, very charismatic. And I read somewhere at one point in time, himself and Fred Hampton were attempting to organize together. As we know, white people, under the code name of COINTELPRO, destroyed that relationship through fictitious letters, writing and writing to each one of those very charismatic young people that Jeff Fort is trying to kill Fred Hampton, and vice versa, Fred Hampton trying to kill Jeff Fort, so on and so forth. And in turn, they had an understanding of what was going a somewhat of a basic understanding, but they didn't understand fully on what was going on at the time. The same thing took place in the original area, quote-unquote state of the Black Panther Party, with Al Prince's Bunty Carter and the Black Panther Party, and the organization that's called United Slaves. The white people also did a very good job of putting a wedge in between those groups, and in turn, it resulted into the murder of Al Prince's Bunty Carter and another black male. I can't remember his name right now. As well as the relationship was permanently destroyed between Jeff Fort and Fred Hampton. So that's something that actually is an extension from what she was talking about with Jeff Fort. That and all of this was before drugs were introduced to these so-called gangs, these groups of young black males. This was before that period of time. And like I said before, they were gaining some success into bringing more understandings of the system of race and white supremacy to some of these quote unquote groups. Thank you.
Copy heard.
Yes, sir. This will be our last comment before we get to the second audio. Go ahead, Thomas in New York.
Do you want me to reserve until later, Cuss?
It doesn't matter.
It
doesn't matter. Proceed.
Okay, I just wanted to give you your kudos because you were definitely on a roll with your observations. Man, I still get excited when I'm going to the white part of town. Ooh, you can see how the white people live. So, I think you were right on point with that. And as far as what you said, because last week, man, we live said, push the white lady on the train. I was like, no, don't push the white lady. I've seen where black people jump in and beat the black dude up for doing something like that before. You know, it's like there's no distress. I mean, that's very dangerous. You know, yeah, the power. I mean, yeah, you hit it right on the head. I mean, they took the money out of his check. Like, that's gangster. I mean, it don't get more. You mean, to run down on someone and take the money out of their pocket. I mean, that's a slow move. I mean, just take it straight out of their check. That's gangster. And I respect that. Good. That was a great observation, guys.
For sure. We will, if you have other comments, hey, the second audio segment is short. It's like 10 minutes. So you won't even have to wait long, but you can jot it down if you have other comments you want to get in about anything that was said, first segment, whatever. You will have time because we don't have that much to listen to. So this is the second audio segment. Leonida McLean, Foot in Each World, Context of White Supremacy. We will be right back real quick, so don't get distracted.
December 21st, 1983, high cost of out-of-wedlock births. Some 55% of black children are being born out of wedlock. You don't have to be moralistic and point your finger to shame anyone about that statistic to realize that it does not bode well for Black families or the race as a whole. Its effects can be seen in the infant mortality rate and in the health of the infants who survive. Its effects have been proven on Black income. The median Black income actually would have increased from 1970 to 1980, except for the changes in family composition. The proliferation of poor female-headed households due to the rising divorce rates and births to single, primarily teenage mothers held down the median. It would have risen from $12,674 to $14,830, but with adjustments for these families, it was only $13,325. Of course, the effects on these children as they grow is more disturbing and is not as easily quantifiable. It cannot be put dramatically in a figure, but ultimately will be more costly than any number could relate. Will these children show a pattern of underachievement in school? There already is proof of a pattern in teen mothers begetting future teen mothers. The illegitimate birth rate can be discussed academically and blamed on failed sex education, the decline of the American family, and permissiveness generally. But ultimately, the blame and blame is such a moralistic sounding word in this context must fall on those young men and women who are parenting. It is time for Black people to confront the enormity of the problem and its implications for future progress. It is time to say to the mothers and fathers, stop and think. Some Black people can get terribly defensive on this topic. After years of hearing how useless we are and all having babies and on welfare from other people, it is hard to admit that there is the slightest truth in that the problem exists. But to admit to the problem does not mean to accept or to give validity to the reasoning of those malicious perpetrators of the stereotype. They can be ignored so long as the problem is tackled. And some people still do hold to a fear of genocide as justification for being fruitful. Being fruitful once, mistakenly, is not necessarily cause of condemnation. Being overly fruitful is. Teachers and adults who work with unwed parents are forever saying that the problem with the problem is that there is no stigma attached to teen pregnancy any longer. It is not something to be whispered about, but often to be paraded about. At a Dallas high school, a 17-year-old unwed mother was voted homecoming queen recently. Most people did not know she had a 2.5-year-old daughter until the child showed up at the dance. Lots of parents protested, trying to get the girl dethroned. But many students said they did not care. They should. The sin of it all is not so much in having the children as in having them without being able to provide for them. Something is terribly amiss when a young man can strut around a high school with a photo pen of offspring for whom he cannot buy milk, with whom he may never live. Young people should be made to face up to the ugliness of their neglect in bringing forth a thing of beauty. There are so many factors at play that a single solution is impossible. Young girls needing attention or wanting to escape home and be on their own. Young unemployed men needing a way to feel some manliness and self-esteem and in control of something or someone. A simple dare or thrill-seeking. But all of these bombarding social factors eventually come down to two people, and their immaturity, chronologically or otherwise, is becoming less and less of an excuse.
the greater burden will fall on the females. Unfair as that may seem, it will be ever thus. And so the greater responsibility for preventing this problem must fall upon females. Don't count on the guys, my dear. Abstinence, I fear, is too naive a suggestion anymore. There is enough contraceptive information and enough contraceptive suppliers around to meet this requirement. Getting young girls to partake of them is something that the black community cannot afford to be shy about. April 18, 1984. Hope for the troubled black family. The black family is in a woeful state, plagued by unemployment, an incredible 50% illegitimate birth rate, and the domestic tensions that follow from these. But at least now this ugly truth is being acknowledged, from the new conservative voices to the rock-ribbed old liberals, and some even more to the left. Finally, blacks are not silencing those who pointed out and are in fact saying so themselves. What has become of values, of hope, of aspirations? Slowly it is becoming permissible, even fashionable, to deal with the topic. The only impediment to solving the crisis of the black family may be that the variant philosophical camps are spending too much time trying to place blame. So strident are they in defending their ideology that they may overlook the significance of having found common ground just in admitting that a crisis exists. They may also overlook a sensible joint solution that could draw from each perspective. One school holds that the decline of black families is due to liberal do-gooder programs. President Reagan is, of course, the best-known proponent of this approach, but it is significant that there is a growing black conservative view that feels no compunction about saying so. It espouses free market economics and trickle-downism that will benefit everyone. This view is ridiculed by most blacks because it ignores the burden of racism. On the other side are those who cleave to the liberal do-gooder programs, but who are at last admitting that these programs need revision. They have seen the good these programs have done and lament that lending a hand to the less fortunate of whatever color is out of vogue in the government, among corporations, and in everyday American life. But even they can no longer ignore the regression that has occurred simultaneously with the progress of blacks over the last two decades. In 1960, 75% of black families were two-parent. Now 50% are headed by women. Then there are views such as those of California sociologists Nathan and Julia Hare in their new book, The Endangered Black Family, Coping with the Unisexualization and Coming Extinction of the Black Race. They come to the same sad conclusion about the black family, but from yet another route. They rail against the genocidal conspiracy, homosexuality, and even the primarily white women's liberation movement for easing black men out of the job market. But even from this radical approach, the conclusion is clear. There is trouble in black homes. Whether any side has the ultimate understanding is not the issue. What is that all sides find the frankness to speak out and at last agree on the problem, if not its causes or solutions. The significance of this relationship was foreseen in an article by New York journalist Elizabeth Wright in 1982, American Blacks and the Cultural Facts of Life, in the Lincoln Review Quarterly. The Quarterly is a publication of the London Institute for Research and Education in Washington, which bills its work as re-examining
the social policies of the 60s and has conservative leanings. Wright wrote that after years of coerced silence, a weary and disillusioned band of defectors, both black and white, are ready to break ranks and speak of the formerly unspeakable. Too many blacks learned to use avoidance techniques to deny the evidence of deep-seated negative cultural patterns within the group. That kind of talk was once seen as traitorous, and white liberals were as quick to silence it as blacks, as were blacks. But even black leaders of the pure liberal persuasion can bite their tongues no more. 30 black scholars gathered under the auspices of the Joint Center of Political Studies in Washington last year to formulate a policy framework for social justice. Law professor Eleanor Holmes Norton, former head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, was its chief spokesperson. The report predictably pointed fingers at racism and denounced Reaganistic solutions, but it was unpredictable and refreshingly candid about the enormity of the crisis. Of course, it still saw government as the primary salvation, but it did say that social programs should be revamped. This is revolutionary, especially at a time when such pronouncements could be taken by the conservatives as proving their point. Conservatives have a point in their bootstrapism, and few know better than blacks who start the race bootless what that can achieve. Liberals have a point in wanting to maintain social programs, and few know better than blacks what can be achieved through these programs. The solution lies somewhere in the mean.
Very short, very short. Context of white supremacy. So we will wrap this book up next Friday, all done. If folks have commentary for this week, feel free to chime in. But next week we are all done with this book. And the next book, finally, the number one vote getter, when folks, listeners voted on what we were supposed to be reading way back at the end of 2015, Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid. So we will start that 2 weeks from today. If folks want to get busy getting their hands on a copy of the book, Medical Apartheid, 2 weeks from today, we will pick that up. But in the meantime, if you would like to share any comments, either on the articles that we talked about during the first audio segment or the two that we just heard, feel free. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We have a little less than 30 minutes left. If you have commentary you want to get in, the person that dialed in 1664, if you had commentary, we'll go to you first, because I don't think we heard you after during the first segment, and then we'll get everybody else. 1664, did you have commentary? Caller at 16, last four digits, 1664, 16664, 1664, did you have commentary? Okay, not here.
Hello there. I'm sorry that took me so long. This is Karma. Good evening, everyone. So nice to be enjoying this book with you. Anyway, I'm just going to give a little bit of pushback on the family catastrophe of the unwed mothers. And I mean, it is a catastrophe. It is regrettable, but certainly not as big of a catastrophe as racism and white supremacy. So I found a way to kind of speak with people who say that a lot, And I do say that, yeah, a lot of the young people, they're terrible parents. Some of these are the worst mothers, and you say they could never be a worse mother, and then you actually meet a worse mother. They seem to have no judgment. They don't think things through. These are not your deep thinkers. But I said, you know, exactly what's going to happen in Flint, Michigan in about 10 or 12 years when all of these children who have been permanently brain damaged, they're going to lack the cognitive skills they need to make good decisions. A lot of people aren't going to appreciate that, and they're going to be out there, and they're going to make some mistakes, and you might have 100%, you know, 100% unwed mothers there. And I said, and no one's going to remember to blame Governor Snyder, the person who is most responsible for that. They'll just be talking about how these black children are completely feral, and they're just out there, and they're having sex and making whoopee and just having babies right and left, and no one remembers this trauma. It's just so hard for us to imagine that maybe we've all had cognitive insults. So I caution us all when we're blaming one another, not knowing the depth of trauma that we've endured and what this has caused. So even though it is a catastrophe, we need to look for, at least make a real honest effort to look for a further deeper cause. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
For sure. The other folks who dialed in from a block number, did you all have commentary that you wanted to get in, or are you all just listening?
Well, I do have a comment. Can I be heard, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
I agree with the last caller about the unwed mother situation, because I feel that, the issue of, are these black children worthless? And you always hear people saying, you know, you have all these unwed mothers producing these worthless children. And that's the tenor of the discussion I think we have to try to get away from and stop blaming each other. Because if you recall, during World War II, Nazi Germany, I believe that they, you know, the white supremacists encouraged single, blonde, Aryan women to have children, to have sex with these officers. They even, you know, provided them with funding, and they were unwed, and those children were welcomed, you know, with open arms, because they were, you know, enhancing the race and so forth. And maybe we need to stop and think that, you know, yeah, we do have a catastrophe, but try to look at it that now we have four people, we have four black babies, whether they are from unwed homes or not, or single parents, divorced, or teenage, we have a more of a pool of our children that, you know, and maybe we need to have our own organizations to help support these kids instead of looking at them as problems and the parents as problems, and turn that into a positive, which is what, I hate to compare it, but which is what Adolf Hitler did. You know, he actually encouraged these unwed mothers to have these children to better their race. And I'll mute my line. I could be wrong, though.
Right on.
Can you hear?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I just want to say I don't think there's anything wrong with children born out of quote-unquote wedlock. If as long as they're being cared for, I think that's something we have adopted from a European concept about children should have a mother and father in the home. I mean, a mother and father should be there somewhere, but I don't think there's anything wrong with children being born out of wedlock, and I don't agree with black people having abortion because it's a young girl and she doesn't have the father is not with her. I think abortion is one of the things that has, you know, one of the number one causes of murder of our people in the last 40 or 50 years. And I think, I might get, people might say I'm wrong for this, but I don't see anything wrong with black people being on welfare and getting health and welfare. They owe us anyway. The government owes us anyway. I mean, if the mother or who is ever taking care of the child cannot care for the child, then they should be able to get assistance from the government. And I think we should bring back the nuclear family, where there's, you know, a number of family members in the house that can, you know, can care for the children that are born out of so-called wedlock. Like they say, it takes a village to raise a child. I mean, in my family, I have aunts that were trying to be so high class that they felt like, you know, if you have a daughter or whatever that has a child, I wear like, oh, go take them to get an abortion. You know, this looks bad. This is gonna make the family look bad. Like, who cares? I mean, with black people, they're gonna look. Who's gonna look down on us? You know, and I mean, and this is a human life. This is a black human life. We're talking about killing. I have a cousin, and she had a baby in high school, and my aunt was so angry because she said she didn't have to have that baby. She could have went to nursing school. I didn't say anything because she was my aunt, and I was trying to respect her. But I was like, who says she can't have a baby and not attend nursing school? That was stupid. And now this cousin is a teacher, and she has four kids, and she's married. You know, so I think that's something that black people really need to get over, this abortion and being ashamed of having family members with kids out of wedlock and all that. Like I said, as long as the kid is taken care of properly and there's family members there to help take care of the child, or other people that may not even be family members that can help raise the child, that's what's most important. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
For sure. All the other folks who were with us during the first segment, Thomas in New York, I just heard you, retired firefighter, Roz, and all of you all are here. And then if anybody else, if you have something you want to get, you should get your hand up right now. Thomas in New York, proceed.
Yes, the conditions that caused the single mothers, the latchkey kids, the abortions, it's all a part of the system of racism, white supremacy to start with. Just the mindset of our people in general is all programming through the white supremacist system. So, you know, that's all I have to say about that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a single parent, you know. In fact, I would bet that more white women have abortions, more white women are single parents, doing single moms than is black people are. It's just that, you know, the stigmatism is always on us. And my last comment, I look forward to the next book because it seems like all the books we've read so far, they sort of, you know, add insight to what's going on now. Like this book, I think, did kind of just looking back 30 years ago and kind of putting things into perspective as to what's occurred now, especially the Obama effect with the mayor of Chicago. That correlation was just perfect. So I look forward to the next book. And sections of this book, you know, it had me thinking of Richard Williams. He went to Chicago, and his interaction with the police, and kind of makes me question if that really happened. You know, the days and days of just going and fighting this one cop every day, I just don't see that happening. And I'm with my mom. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I was actually thinking because the two females who were talking about children out of wedlock and that stigma, it reminds me of my own situation when my wife was pregnant with our son. We weren't married, and her parents, my in-laws at the time, were very embarrassed at some point about the fact that we weren't married. And the thing was, we basically treated each other with the respect of a married couple long before we got married. So actually she wanted to be defiant and actually not get married at all. I wanted to get married simply because I knew that if anything happened to me, I didn't want her to have any potential issues, legally speaking, with anybody coming out of, in my family, coming out of left field and trying to take anything that belonged to her. So that was my reason for wanting to get married. But just to speak on, I wanted to touch on a couple things from the previous segment. In regards to the comments that Thomas in New York made on the projects, it's really interesting because the term projects were not used for those developments until Black people moved in. When it was Eastern Black Europeans and Jews who lived in those places, they were called basically housing developments, and they were sprawling, green, well taken care of grounds, things like that. And when the Black people moved in, that's when they stopped taking care of the grounds. That's when it became quote unquote dangerous, and everything, the property value plummeted. So I just found that very interesting because there's been massive amounts of experiments. I remember Dick Gregory had a discussion on YouTube where he talked about chemtrails and how in some cases they would actually have chemtrails over projects, and whatever chemicals were in those chemtrails, they would like fly jets over these places, and the effects, the health, negative health effects that these, whatever they were spraying over these communities were having on the people. I think the move, in the move situation, they also talked about similar things where they were spraying chemicals on the people in that neighborhood in Philadelphia. Also, when you talked about, Gus, when you talked about what a gang looks like, I was going to say what we view as a gang is what has been psychosocially conditioned into us through media and entertainment, simply because you're absolutely right. If you look at the Crips and the Bloods, Red and Blue, and you look at the Republicans and the Democrats, they're gangs. The military is a gang. We look at men in uniform as if they're not gangs, but they're gangs. They're just organized and they're dressed in uniform, but they function as organized gangs that have the law on their side because of racism, white supremacy. So I found that really interesting. And also when you talked about Black people being clean for going to church and being amongst white people, it reminded me of an incident where my sister-in-law was really, really young. I forget what her age was, but she was probably, I'm thinking somewhere in the single digits, somewhere between 7 and 9. And she was at school and she was surrounded and psychologically terrorized by a bunch of white race soldiers, children, who told her that, called her a nigger and told her that she was dirty. And that's why she was dark. So she relayed the story, as well as my wife, that she went home and scrubbed her skin raw, trying to get what she thought was dirt off when it was actually her melanin. So that was, and I remember just the look on her face retelling that story and the psychological damage it had on her. And she's a lighter skinned Black female. My wife is actually the darker one out of the two. So so that was just, it just immediately brought that story to mind in my family. And to get to the section of the book reading, on page, oh yeah, with the high cost of out of wedlock births, there's one line on page 152 where she says, there's already proof of a pattern in teen mothers begetting future teen mothers. And it just kind of reminds me of what you brought up with the American Slave Coast and the half has never been told. And it really makes me think of the fact that the terrorism that we went through, where they broke up our families and they forced Black males to be studs, and they were forcibly raping and having young black female children raped, created and was really the origin of this whole process. And that we don't understand, I think, sometimes how some of this behavior is like in our DNA. Like, we've been dealing with this for so long and in so many myriad of ways that it's like coded in our DNA that these things keep happening, and then the system is set up so that these things continue to happen. Because I, as a young person, had issues in my house with my mother. I lived with my mother. Her and my father broke up when I was like 4 months old. And, you know, I'd had major issues with my mother coming up, and I started having sex at a young age. So these are the things, like the family situation kind of generates that behavior. Because, and Dr. Wilson talked about that as well, the fact that if a child is not getting the love and nurturing that they get at home, they seek it through sexual activity. I'm living proof of that. I started at 14 years old, and it was the worst decision I ever made. But ultimately, listening to Dr. Wilson helped me to understand that fact, that if you don't give your children what they need emotionally and spiritually and as a parent, that guidance, that they're looking for, they're going to seek it in the arms of someone else and through sexual activity, because that's what's inculcated in us from a very young age. And then there's a brief section on the other page, the following page 153, where she says the sin of it all is not so much in having the children as in having them without being able to provide for them. Something is terribly amiss when a young man can strut around a high school with a photo pin of offspring for whom he cannot buy milk, with whom he may never live. Young people should be made to face up to the ugliness of their neglect in bringing forth a thing of beauty. And it just kind of reminds me of basically anti-blackness, simply for the fact that it's the system of white supremacy is why that young man would not be able to take care of his children, cannot buy milk. And I know specifically ever since the welfare system was created, anytime a black female is on welfare, she is not allowed legally to have a male living in the house. They even send representatives from the welfare office, and they will search your house, your apartment, go through your closets to make sure there's no male there. Because if there's a male there, essentially Uncle Sam will stop giving you those checks, because they basically, Uncle Sam becomes your financial father. So they don't want a black male. They're playing the role of a male in the house. So it's actually coded in the DNA of the laws in this country to break up the black family, no different than the slave master broke up our families hundreds of years ago. So to me, that just shows she had a serious lack of understanding of that history, and then the anti-blackness that ensues from not really understanding that historical record. And also, the hope for the troubled black family. I think I already spoke on that when I talked about my own situation earlier. So thank you very much, and I'll mute my line there.
Did we get everybody? Everybody who had comments to get in spoken? Right on. I will get in a few of my own comments, and then if anybody had anything quick they wanted to get in before we wrap up, we should have time for that too. It was published late, but if it had been published earlier today, today, April 8th, I would have made this the introduction for today's program. Last week when she had the article talking about the Ronald Reagan policies during the 80s when he was president that were weakening criminal defense attorneys, making it more difficult for black people once they were charged with a crime to have adequate legal defense. It was just reported today in Chicago, Cook County, that they are removing lockers from the courtrooms in Cook County. And the result of this is that defendants, they won't be able to have a phone. Apparently, the courtrooms in Cook County in Chicago, they don't allow phones in the courtroom. And so they had pay lockers outside the courtroom, and you could pay whatever the money is, and then you could just put your pay phone and whatever else in the locker. But they tore them all out, and they were saying how this is going to be a huge problem, traumatizing people all over again. Either you have to throw your phone away, it gets confiscated, you can't get in touch with relatives, just causing all of these problems for black people who have already been subjected to terrorism and mistreatment. Chicago's John Burge and the Chicago Police Department. But now this was just reported today going down in Chicago 2016. It would have been the introduction today because it's right in line with what she was talking about last week. Anywho, the segments that we heard, the last two articles, it reminded me one of our guests from 2012, Shafia Monroe, black female. She is the founder of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. She is a midwife where she talks a lot about traditional African birth practices and how this can aid not just the black female, but the entire black family, child, the father, everybody. But she said she is a well-educated black female, has founded this incredibly important organization, does lectures, tours all over the world, helps all of these people, moms, families, be healthy and give birth and not have all the complications and bills and unnecessary stress of going into racist-dominated healthcare centers. She does all of this. She has a master's degree, well-educated. She's married. And she says when she was pregnant with child, she has several children, but when she was pregnant, it's never anything to celebrate. It's always, oh, God, having a child. And she said that is always the pattern for black females. Black children are never to be celebrated unless we're talking plantation times. Then it's, oh, goody, more money for master. But Anytime beyond that, oh, God, another nigger child on planet Earth. Just, you sure you don't want to get on the board? Are you sure? Oh, man. Why? She talked about this in depth 2012, and that echoed as we heard both of those essays. It reminded me, white people, they can celebrate. They have these television programs on MTV and what have you, 16 and Pregnant and all this nonsense. The problem, and I'm not, you know, encouraging or saying that we should celebrate a 14-year-old or a teen having a child, or just anyone, regardless of age, having a child in a situation where they don't have resources to adequately take care of the child. Dr. Welsing talked about that all the time. But, I mean, understanding first and foremost, and, I mean, if we're going to point blame and be upset, it's racism, white supremacy that makes it so that black people, regardless of age, don't have adequate resources to take care of a child, even adequate resources about themselves and what it means to be a parent. Racists are responsible for denying us all of that information, resources, information being a resource first and foremost. But it reminded me that white women, they can get pregnant at any age, any time, whatever the resources. And it's, oh, man, even in my opinion, that's a lot of what you're seeing right now in them working to hamper abortions. They want more white babies, white genetic annihilation, pushing all of that. I think Thomas in New York brought that up before. Once abortion came legal, skyrocketed the number of dark people getting abortions and figuring out new ways to decrease the numbers of dark people being born. The exact opposite for white people. Let's do any and everything that we can to make sure that we've got those white babies, next generation of race soldiers being born. It also reminded me, those essays reminded me of Tater Pie. She's been a guest participant, caller on the program repeatedly over the years. She made a comment, this is years ago, like 2009, where she said that she thinks a lot of the younger black people, teenage black females getting pregnant, she thinks that it is sensing, even on a subconscious level, sensing that we are in a very dangerous environment where you might not live very long, and or by the time that you are older and quote unquote mature, that you might not have access to a male to procreate with. So we need to do this now, that there might be a biological drive on this, sensing the dangerous, racist dominated environment that we are in. So she said this to me in 2009. She shared it's in the archives on the program. Lo and behold, I talked to Dr. Cambon some years later, and he said the exact same thing, that there's research that this happens. If you observe other animals, that they will do the exact same thing. If they sense they're in an environment where they might not be able to procreate because the environment is dangerous, they might not be able to do it at a later date. So they will do this really quick when they're young, just to procreate and sustain the species. And he too thinks that this might be some of what is happening now with black people. Just tossing that out because this did remind me of that. I thought it was interesting when she said, this is in the essay where she's talking about hope for the troubled black family. I thought it was interesting, number one, that this was April 18th, 1984. So this is like a month before her suicide when she wrote this essay. But when she talked about Julia and Nathan Hare. So this is on page 154, like the second to last paragraph, when she references their book, The Endangered Black Family, Coping with the Unisexualization and Coming Extinction of the Black Race. Maybe something folks should check out from the library or get a copy of the book. But when she talked about their work and she referenced their research and theories as radical, that is a term that I am on alert for when I hear it being used to brand the scholarship of black people, because I don't hear, like, just I'm moving down and I'm acknowledging I don't know if Elizabeth Wright is a black person. I strongly suspect that this is a white woman, suspected racist, where she's writing about American blacks and cultural facts in the Lincoln Review. This is a London Institute for Research and Education. I could be wrong, but I suspect this is a white woman. She didn't reference her as radical. And I consistently don't see whites get referenced as radical. This term, not always, but I've seen it a number of times. I would say more often than not, in my perception, this term is used in some way to delegitimize, to invalidate, to change the way that you perceive and think about These are well-educated black people. They have doctorates. These are not some black people that just, you know, sat around and thought, oh, this will be cool. Maybe we can make a few books and put this together. They have published many books. They're still alive, have written a lot of great material that has a lot of solid information about racism, white supremacy. I would not label anything that they have written, whether I would agree with it or not, I would not label it radical. Either it's accurate or it's not. It's just been my view, because that term has been used on myself and others as well. And I don't hear people say Timothy Wise is radical. I don't hear people say Jane Elliott is radical. They will use other terms, other adjectives to describe the work that they are doing, to talk about, to describe, articulate racism, white supremacy, not radical. Anyway, and in fact, President Obama talked about that term as well in Dreams from My Father. He has a whole section. I could pull it up if we had more time, but he had a whole section in the book where he talked about using that word to exactly what I'm saying, to invalidate a black person. And it's basically a half a step away from calling you a nigger. Not that I'm implying she was doing that, but I'm on alert about the use of that term. The only other thing I will get in, just with the whole welfare, nobody gets more welfare, quote unquote, than whites under the system of racism, white supremacy, whether we're talking food stamps, TANF, or whether we're talking massive tax breaks with everything that came out this week about whites having all of these creative, exotic means of hiding tax revenues in other parts of the globe so they don't have to give up their coins. Nobody gets more handouts and does more mooching off of the quote-unquote government than whites. And I'm not saying that that's something that, you know, blacks should try to emulate. But just again, whites, they've done a really skillful job. Same thing like with the what we think of reflexively, intuitively, when we think gangster and the image that we have in mind. The same thing with welfare. We do not think of whites. And I mean, it's no contest. Whites are the best. Really, this whole system of racism, white supremacy is about setting up welfare for whites, white genetic annihilation. I will stop there. Anybody have a final sentence they want to get in before we conclude? Everybody satisfied? Spectacular. We will wrap up next week. All done. Last section, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, has been a very informative read. You should be thinking of concluding thoughts, major themes that you'll take away from the book, any other, views, black mental health and how that evolved through the book in terms of what we see with her writing. But that'll be next week. We will be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here on Sunday. John Patash, his second visit, he wrote The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. He mentions Fred Hampton in that book a lot. We'll be talking about his most recent book, Drugs as a Weapon Against Us. Very interesting book, particularly with the climate about legalize everything. I'm very excited. I talked to him back in 2013. This book was published last year, but he said he was in the process of writing this book when I called him in 2013 to get his thoughts on the euphoria about legalizing cannabis and now everything else. But we'll be talking about his book. That'll be Sunday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. He is a white male, suspected racist. And then Tuesday, we were supposed to have the program yesterday, Vernon Burton, professor down at Clemson in South Carolina. We rescheduled, but he'll be here Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So we'll be here every day for the next, 5 days, except for Monday. If you have problems, gripes, questions, suggestions, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks to all the folks who chimed in, shared their thoughts. Great discussing the content and looking forward to wrapping it up next week. Again, you can go ahead and get Medical Apartheid 2 weeks from today. We will start that book. So if you want to get your hands and have a hard copy as we go through it, feel free. Looking forward to reading that because that was the top vote getter. We were supposed to have read that months ago. Thanks again. I will say once again, under conditions of white supremacy, sobriety would be best. Certainly, if you're going to be behind the wheel, I know it's getting warm. It was spectacular to hear. Really, it's been beautiful here the whole week, but it warmest day of the year by far. It was almost 80 degrees. It was incredible. It was a little bit sad to be inside discussing racism, white supremacy, but hopefully constructive. If you're going to be out gallivanting, enjoying the warmer weather, man, you do not want to be lax in your codification. If you're going to be behind the wheel, passenger, pedestrian, even, driver, passenger, pedestrian. You do not want to be intoxicated. You never know when it will be John Burge, Daniel Holdsclaw, Darren Wilson, who is pulling you over and can totally take your life in about 5 seconds. You want to be able to make outstanding decisions to keep yourself as safe as possible. You, any other people that you might be responsible for, certainly buckle up. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Black mental health, extremely important. Be mindful of black mental health. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.